call booths or close check.
Bob almost put on his hazards this morning, but thank God he decided to. What am I doing here? I don't even know what I'm doing here. My goodness, very few people here. Why is that? How long do you think we're gonna go tomorrow?
Can I go on? I just wanted a message. Put one message.
11:30.
Tomorrow?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do we have it? Do we have it?
We can't look that out right now. I need to listen.
Assistant Chief. Who?
Carmel Babich.
Who?
Carmel Babich, Assistant Chief. And then Roland Takayama. They're here temporarily. The Woods of Los Angeles got called away on maintenance. They're here for the divorce. They're gonna hang out.
Okay. Okay. All right. Richard? Okay. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the first day of a two-day hearing of the California Fish and Game Commission. My name is Michael Flores. I'm currently serving as president of the commission. With me on the dais here is Mr. Bob Hatoy from Santa Monica, California, is currently serving as vice president. Next to him is Jim Kellogg, commissioner from Concord, California. Sitting next to me, Mr. Richard Rogers, commissioner from Santa Barbara, California, and Ms. Cindy Gustafson, who is commissioner from Tahoe City, California. Welcome to you all. Also up here is Mr. John Carlson, our executive director, and our assistant executive director, Mr. John Fisher. And who else do we have? And then our award-winning staff, Sherry Cole and Adriana Shea. And with us also is Mr. Sonky Mastrup, Deputy Director from the Department of Fish and Game. And Mr. William Cunningham, our legal counsel. A couple of housekeeping items. We're going to go into public forum, but before we do that, I'm going to exercise my authority to move an item, the waterfowl item, from tomorrow to today. And we'll take that up right up after a public forum. The item number two will take place at about 11:30. Also in the audience with us are our game wardens. I had my list of names here. Mr. Carlson took them from me. Assistant Chief Carmel Babich, Mr. Roland Takayama, and Mr. Todd Tagazzini, who is actually Warden of the Year, and we will be giving that presentation later on today. So thank you all for being here with us. Okay, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you. For public forum, I want to remind the audience that any member of the public may address and or ask questions of the commission relating to implementation of its policies and or any other matter within the jurisdiction of the commission. As a general rule, action cannot be taken on issues not listed on the agenda. Staff will normally be requested to follow up on such items at the discretion of the commission. Submittal of written comments is encouraged to ensure that all comments will be included in the record before the commission. Please be prepared to summarize your comments to the time allotted by the president.
3 minutes.
3 minutes today. So I'll call up the speakers if they could line up behind the podium. We'll start with Amy Cloud, followed by Jim Martin, followed by Eric Mills. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cups.
Step.
Good morning. I want to thank you for letting me speak. This is to the California Fish and Game Commission. We have sent to you the appeal to cancel the California Fish and Game denial to let us have any tags this year. As you have helped us in the past, we are hoping you can help us now. We have sent to Richard Callis all of the papers of the appeal to him. We have been told that you, as commissioners, cannot change this denial. It does not matter that we had no control on circumstances. We have 29 fields. We want to know why, if it's just one field that they are complaining about, should that cause all of your ranch to be denied. We are presenting proof that we did not lie about the hardship of getting our farming done this spring. We did not lie about our 3,000 quail. We sent you a newspaper article about the two people that wrote about their quail hunt on the Clouds Warner Mountain Ranch. We are including two newspaper clippings stating that 52 counties in California were affected and declared disaster areas due to the adverse weather. Also, we are including how bad the fire danger is right now. Of course, since I wrote this, it has lessened, but they expect it to raise again. Why we couldn't get our crops in, the California Fish and Game biologists would not listen to us when we tried to explain. We couldn't get our crops in due to the heavy late rains. We do not feel that this should be held against us for a reason to not get tags. We sent you pictures of our tractor so badly stuck on our highest and gravelliest ground on May 26th with a neighbor pulling the tractor out. We are also showing you pictures of our hard flat field with all the lush grasses, which is included in this report. The quaking aspens and the mahoganies, which we keep for the elk. We did not take pictures of the wild plum brush, but it's in the same condition. This is the field we leave for the elk. There are elk there now. We have fields in the bottom part of Fandango that we haven't turned cattle in this year yet. The one field we had cattle in has grown back up nice and green because cattle graze the old grass that wildlife doesn't like. We also are enclosing pictures of the elk damaged fence. Cattle can crawl in and out, and other people's cattle can get in. The California Fish and Game told us that we need to get out of the... Am I through?
No, you're not. Continue.
Out of the 580 program and get into a private hunting club. We are not set up for a hunting club. Our ranch is a working cattle and hay ranch. We have hunting club, we'd have a cause hardship on our budget. Cabins would have to be built. A cook would have to be hired, and several vans purchased along with high gas prices. Not a good idea. We read in the paper where there are over 50 head of antelope died because of lack of selenium. We are the only ranchers that put out mineralized salt blocks with selenium in them, in our fields and on the U.S. Forest Service and BLM. The salt blocks are used by deer, elk, antelope, and our cattle. We have been very disappointed that the Fish and Game cannot bend any of the rules when circumstances are happening beyond your control of anyone. We are now in extreme fire danger conditions, so our fencing will have to pause for a cooler period. We have built 6 miles of fence already this spring, and the papers, the newspapers, and the pictures are included on this back of this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Same subject or?
No, it's
Would you like the department response?
We want the department's response.
Yeah.
Hold on a second, sir. Jim, we're going to get to you in a second.
Yeah. Good morning, commissioners. As you know, some of you, that I have a long history with the PLM program in my former job. The department's worked very hard to develop this program. It used to be an incredibly controversial program. And over the years, we have come to a system that everybody accepts as fair and equitable in terms of it's a program to enhance lands. In exchange for that enhanced lands, the commission authorizes tags or special hunt opportunities as a compensation to encourage wildlife habitat on these lands. A wonderful program. The nature of the program is based on a contract between, a literal contract between the department and each landowner that's tailored to the individual ranch and the wildlife and what we can do on a ranch. It is a contractual agreement. Based on that, we then negotiate tags which the commission authorizes. But I want to emphasize the contract is between the department and the landowner. What you're only hearing, and we appreciate the clouds and their operation in the past, this is really a matter of obligations under a contract. What you're not hearing is we have worked relentlessly over the years. This is not a one-time situation, trying to work with them to live up to an agreement we had contractually. They have failed repeatedly over the years to live up to their end of the contract, to the point where it's really not fair to the hunting community any longer to provide these special opportunities for what we're getting in return in habitat work. If they can't live up to the agreement, the contract, they should not be entering voluntarily into these contracts. But I've got to, this is so bad now, I'm literally jeopardizing the integrity of the PLM program by continuing this, because the other landowners are looking at these things. They're going, well, if you're not holding them accountable for the agreement, why should you hold me accountable? It's a matter of fairness and contractual obligation. The department is more than willing to work with them. But at this point, we can no longer justify this arrangement until we kind of reset, get things going. They need to do a little bit of catch-up so that we're satisfied there's an honest and legitimate ability to live by the terms of the contract. We would love to have them back in the program, but this is a matter of program credibility at this point.
Sankey, are you prepared at this point or to make comments about what it would take for them to get back in good standing? Or is that too technical in that sense?
I won't get into nitty-gritties, right. But the basically is a lot of these ranches, we negotiate specific, you know, fence off this piece of stream habitat to enhance wildlife habitat, reduce grazing pressure here, plant some friendly wildlife vegetation here. It's miscellaneous things like that. They've just not been performing them. It's not one time. It's many. This has occurred over many years. So,
and different sorts of
different
things.
Sorts. Different and sorts. And we're simply asking for a chance to catch up. I mean, we've essentially got a backlog of IOUs that they've not been good on. And we just want to make sure to protect the integrity of the PLM program so that the state is getting in return for these opportunities something legitimate in terms of habitat.
Do you forecast that they would have the ability this year to reset?
That is something the department is completely willing to sit down with the owners of the property and work out some terms to get back there. But at this point, we cannot, with any straight face, agree to give them permits given this track record.
Thank you.
It's time to settle the arrangement and make sure it's workable. If they can't afford to participate, that's a decision they need to look at. But I can't give these tags away free. It completely undermines the program.
Mr. Flores, may
yes.
I? I do not understand why he thinks we haven't done our. We have a whole bunch of fields that we do not turn in for the elk. What? They're good. I have pictures there of how the feed looks in the back. Of the pictures,
mm-hmm.
and The reason that we couldn't get some of this in was on account of the weather projections.
Right.
I can't understand why he thinks that we don't.
Well, my understanding is that it's an accrual of items that have occurred over multiple years.
I do not know.
And not just this one year.
They've never said anything before.
That's not a fact, and we can provide you the documentation if you'd like it.
Written documentation on that?
Yes, we have the actual contract agreements, okay. And then we do cite. Part of the arrangement is every year we kind of rotate and do verification visits, and we have that all documented if you really
And you cite it. Them, you send them, how do you, what's the interaction when there's a...
Typically we'll notify them that...
How?
Personal visits, phone calls, letters, we use various means. I mean, these properties are scattered all over the state, and... So we communicate them in various venues, but I can give you a history if you want. We can work this out. It's time to make this work.
What I'd like to see is both parties get together, agree to terms, and you meet those obligations, and then the commission would be more than happy to support you. But you're going to have to meet those terms.
Mr. Flores?
Yes.
We've tried to get Mr. Shin up there. He says, well, I can give you, he won't even talk to us on the phone lots of times. He says, I can't talk to you, I will not talk to you. And then when he comes, I only got just so little bit, I can only go look at a certain place, and then I've got to go back. He's sitting in his office with this darn computer almost the time because he has no other way to get out.
Okay. Well, the commission is not in a position, without the two of you working out what your problems are. The department is not in business to put you out of business in that particular instance. They're trying to actually get you to perform. It would be in their vested interest to have you perform properly on your contract.
But we have been. I can't understand why you think so.
Well, the department very specifically thinks that's not true. So what you need to do is get together, and we would be delighted, speaking for myself, we would be delighted to hear your progress in getting back together
again.
I am a farmer. I am a rancher. I understand what it is to have weather issues. I lost millions this year because of that.
Yes.
I understand that. I understand contracts, too.
Well, we do, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Sankey. Mr. Martin.
Thank you, President Flores. My name is Jim Martin, and I'm with the Recreational Fishing Alliance, and I'd like to thank the commission for your stamina yesterday. That was a long meeting, and I think you accomplished a lot. I brought up on item number two, asked a question about whether we could have some time on the Monterey agenda meeting on the 15th about getting our, about 15 minutes. For a look at the peer review of the socioeconomic study. And I think some of the things that came out at the end of that meeting showed that the fishermen felt like they were being much more impacted than was reflected in some of the data that you were shown. I think it was like 10%. I think some people felt like they were going to be shut out completely. And I think that's an important aspect to investigate before we move forward in other regions. So I don't know if it's appropriate to ask the commission to discuss this now or just ask that question. And can somebody help me here?
We'll take that under advisement.
Take it under advisement. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
One other comment about the public comment cards and how we can facilitate or, narrow down some of this thing. Part of the reason that was so long is a lot of people were filling out comments, and what we wanted to do was narrow down things to a few spokespeople, and that didn't quite happen. And I'm hoping that can happen better on the 15th so we don't have another 12-hour meeting. So
it's kind of hard to do, Jim, given the nature
of
public discourse.
Part of it was half our group was outside, half of it was in. People didn't know when it was appropriate to make what kind of comment. And if we could work together a little bit, I think we can make the meeting run a lot more smoothly. So that's a comment I'd like to make. Action needed.
I understand, Jim. But as you know, it's incumbent upon the commission to hear people, individuals,
absolutely.
The extent to which we have the time available. So.
Absolutely.
It's kind of, yes, it may have been a 12-hour marathon session yesterday, but still, that's why we make the big
bucks. I don't
want
to cut off anybody. I'm saying that there were people there that would like to pass their time on that didn't realize when that was appropriate, and I think it would have gone more quickly if we had had some kind of better system in place.
Well, I thought I had given enough fair warning on that. I mean, I explained
numerous,
numerous times over 12 hours.
Bill Shinsky, the gentleman that came here, I mean, I couldn't have paid him what he makes on a consulting fee, and then he gave up with Chevron, and all he got, you know, there was a misconception about how much time he had, and I felt really bad about that. And there were other people that spoke when they didn't need to, so.
Repeatedly.
And I mean, we could show up here with 100 guys and But
it's a public process. What can we do?
I mean,
we could show up here with 100 guys and pass our cards to Paul Weakman.
Is that a threat?
No.
Paul was here. Where is he?
He's here.
Yeah.
At least he was here.
He was here a minute ago.
Okay.
Actually, I'm not sure where Paul is, but he has a speaker card in. He's after Eric, so if he could, if you want, I think he's in the hall.
Don't make me follow Paul, please. Good morning. Eric Mills is my name. I'm coordinator of Action for Animals. Good morning, President Flores and members of the commission, staff. Sorry to say I'm here to beat a dead horse, but two issues, not quite dead, maybe on life support. Packet I'm just now handing out is an update on the lily pond situation in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park, where, as you know, there's a population of African clawed frogs, which has been there for a little over 3 years. And there are 5 days in there where our herpetologist, Paul Haskins, has been going to the pond every Tuesday when there's a ongoing trapping program. They're catching a couple hundred frogs every Tuesday and taking them back to the Yountville Office for Euthanasia. But Dr. Green at Stanford has estimated as many as 10,000 frogs in the pond, so they're just barely making a dent. I was at the pond Saturday a week ago. The water level was way down, bottles floating in there, debris on the beach. As a result of public complaints, they said they are refilling the pond again, and the trapping program goes on. But again, we implore the department and the commission to do all they can to drain the pond and euthanize everything in there that's not native. I think it's the only solution before these critters get out into the Delta. Mike mentioned also in that article, there's a packet, there's a two-page article from the University of Victoria, British Columbia. They're having some problems with the chytrid fungus, which is, we think, spread around the world by the African clawed frogs, now being carried by the American bullfrogs, non-native to British Columbia, and it's making some of their natives ill. Over 100 species have been exterminated, gone to extinction in Central America because of the virus and the global warming, they think, in combination. Also, you may have seen the photographs that Miles Young turned in to the commission about 10 days ago, I think, showing the conditions of the pond. And I would hope that maybe one of the commissioners might be in the neighborhood. I live in Oakland. I'd be happy to take you over to the pond any day. It's right across from the Conservatory of Flowers in San Francisco. You get a firsthand look at what the situation really is. Mike mentioned, too, there's a reporter, independent reporter from National Geographic, who's doing a story on animal disease transmission to humans, and she spent some time at Lily Pond, too. Don't know what she got, but she was there, so we might get some publicity we don't really want. Secondly, probably more important, it's no surprise that there's a dearth of wardens here in California. I just got the latest report from California Wardens Association. It says we now have, 64 vacancies. We're down to 192 wardens in the field now. There used to be more than 400. I worry that if we don't get this fixed, everything that this commission and department does is going to be moot if we don't have wardens in the field. In Florida, there are 750 wardens, 500 in Texas. We're within 5% pay parity with Nevada. And it closes with, it is predicted that fewer than 100 wardens may be patrolling California in 3 to 5 years if California fails to address the recruitment crisis. And, of course, they make only about 3/5 of what the CHP makes. So appreciate your efforts on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric.
Eric, I'm disappointed we didn't get a Dorothy Parker quote.
Next time.
Paul Weakman.
Commissioners, Paul Weakman. We would like to again request that withering syndrome, the devastating abalone disease, be put on the agenda. We've been taught many, lessons, but the commission is now not allowing us to learn from these. You are concealing information about the outplanting of diseased abalones by aquaculture. And we feel this is wicked, sinister, and evil, and that you are not following through with your stated goals of being honest and truthful with the public. You're not disseminating information correctly. We also would like you to clear up the questions and fraud on the otter issue. We also request that you immediately open for abalone harvesting, San Francisco County, San Mateo Counties, Santa Cruz County, Monterey County, and San Luis Obispo Counties. This is infinite wisdom here. This will avert a lot of problems in the future. What about the otter fraud, the withering syndrome fraud? The fraud connected with these marine protected, no fishing zone, because it doesn't protect the habitat from your number one concern. We're going to talk about San Francisco Bay. The number one concern with habitat in California is pollution, yet the commission never attacks this number one problem. You always attack people, the fishermen. Why are the fishermen being punished for the outplanting of diseased abalones like withering syndrome? No response. The department will not respond about the deceitful way that they've maneuvered and manipulated the withering syndrome studies. They have all been failures, yet you continue to give gobs of grant money out for more failure. You're not going to admit to the past problems. All you do is destroy documents.
Thank you, Mr. Weakland. Mr. Wright.
Good morning, Mr. President and members of the Commission. My name is Al Wright. I'm Executive Director of the California Wildlife Conservation Board, and I come here this morning in somewhat of a privileged position because I represent our board, including our current chair, Mr. Flores, who passed a resolution and thanking Mr. Jim Kellogg for his service for the last 2 years serving as chair as well as president of the commission, and in particular for the Wildlife Conservation Board. It was a pleasure serving your needs, Jim, and your participation on the board. During Jim's tenure on the board approved 26 public access projects that were wildlife-oriented, enhanced fishing piers off the coast of California, boat ramps for fishing purposes. 26,000 acres of land was restored, wetlands, riparian areas, upland habitats. And we protected about 200,000 acres in the state either through fee acquisitions, grants to others for open space that protect habitat as well as conservation easements in the state. I often consider my position a little more white hat than John's, for instance, because our projects are generally non-controversial, but one of the meetings Jim did chair that I certainly appreciate was one of our more significant projects in recent years was the Hearst Ranch Conservation Project, where through it we protected about 80,000 acres of the central coast around the Hearst Castle, as well as conveyed 13 miles of coastline to include in the state park system. So Jim, on behalf of the board and the legislative advisor members, I have a resolution here for you. I just want to say personally thanks also. Job well done.
Where's our photographer?
I have to say that Hearst Ranch testimony was a marathon deal like
that.
Similar. Thank you, Al.
Congratulations, Jim. And Al, I didn't want you to think I was... by not recognizing you, I didn't want to steal the thunder from your presentation, so welcome. Where do we go to next? Yes, let's go to waterfowl.
So we're going to move to item 15, receipt of public testimony on proposed amendments of the migratory game bird waterfowl regulations for 2006-2007. Please note that the adoption hearing is scheduled for our late August meeting in Santa Barbara.
Yeah. What's he doing? I just wonder what he's doing.
He's sitting back there hanging out.
So Mr. Dan Perigary, the waterfowl, senior waterfowl biologist for the department, has a few words on the department's proposal.
Yeah, Thank you, Mr. President. Commission Dan Perigary, Wildlife Branch. Normally, at this discussion hearing, we'd provide you with a brief status update and the department's recommendations specific to zones and seasons and bag limits and stuff. And because we just got the federal frameworks the first part of this week, I'm just going to shave that second part off and provide that to you at your adoption meeting with a little bit of detail today on one thing, but I hope this will go pretty quick as soon as I figure out. There we go. Again, you've seen most of this before. To remind you that your duck regs in this country are set under adaptive harvest management, which is based on mid-continent mallards. Those ducks were up 8% and near the long-term average, so mid-continent mallards are doing fine. All species combined, what we'll call total duck sometime, are also doing quite well, 14% above long-term or last year and above the long-term average. So all ducks combined are doing quite well. In California, there's really five species of ducks that comprise the majority of our harvest: mallards, gadwall, green-winged teal, and shovelers. And three of those are doing quite well. Gadwall are way the heck up there, so are green-winged teal and northern shovelers. Widgeon, however, are in a bit of a decline and are starting to get some folks' attention. So whether or not we'll see some species-specific harvest strategies come down the road from the Fish and Wildlife Service is yet to be seen.
Do you get some new software there? I've never seen it before. It's pretty fancy.
Actually, these are stolen from the Fish and Wildlife Service status video. In a digital world, you can get almost anything you want. Pintail, of course, are vastly important to our state and, unfortunately, mostly only our state in this country. They had a nice uptick again this year, and they're heading toward the long-term average. Unfortunately, as I'll share in a second, the framework still restrains a pretty restrictive bag limit on pintail. And I gave you this bit of information at your Mammoth meeting in June that our surveys in California were up again this year, both all species and mallards, and above the long-term average for both of those. Real briefly, geese are doing well. Up and down in the board, and one thing we'll spend a little bit of time about, we've got some liberalization opportunities on white-fronted geese, and black brant, as you recall, contentiously last year we implemented a 15-day season, and this year they're back above the threshold to allow a 30-day season. So a little bit of detail on brant, as we manage them on the flyway level based on this three-year running average, which is that top line. That's for the flyway population. The management plan goal is 150,000. If the population dips below 110, we go to what we call very restrictive regs, or that 15-day season we had last year. And when they're above that, we go back to what we're calling restrictive, which is the 30-day season. The yellow line is the index in California, and I'll talk to you about that in just a little bit more detail here with a very cumbersome slide. But the trend in California is upward. This is unfortunately a busy graph, and I'm going to spend a minute with it. Look at the green line there, which is the flyway plan goal for wintering brant in California, which is 10,000 birds. If we extended this line back to 1936 when we started counting brant, you would have seen 150,000 brant in California. Over the decades, particularly in the 50s, brant pretty well overshot California and now wintering primarily in Mexico. In 1977, the flyway wrote its first management plan, which set a goal to try and get brant back into the stateside where we might have a little influence over their habitats through coastal zone regulations and stuff. So that green line then is the statewide total. The solid horizontal is the goal, and you can see that in 1980 we were literally at zero brant in California. In 1983 we switched the season from a February season to a fall season, basically the month of November, and we didn't see much response, and slowly things started creeping up. And it's not unusual in these winter indices to see these kind of blips. Brant migrated early, they got counted, but you know, look at the trends more importantly than the point estimates. The flyway plan includes bay-specific goals. So the red line at 5,000 is Humboldt Bay, the black line is 3,000 for Tomales Bay essentially, and the blue line is 2,000 for Morro Bay. So looking at Morro Bay, kind of the good news story is that it too is slowly creeping upward and is essentially near its distribution goal. The black line for Sonoma County or Tomales Bay is about half its goal. However, the red dotted line, which is Humboldt, is quite a bit far below its goal. And the other thing I'll call your attention to is that even though we were generally sort of kind of trending upwards, in about 1998, we switched our season timing and slipped it just a little bit to where we started November 10th and closed December 9th. And while the other two bays kind of maintained their trend in that period, Humboldt's took a dip there for a couple, 3 years before it started coming back up. So the issue that you're going to hear about from some of the brand hunters in the state, and the department will have a recommendation for you later this month, is the specific timing for the seasons in the two zones that we created. Basically, then,
Dan,
the
before you go on, what's the total population of brands, including Mexico?
Well,
what's the estimate?
The midwinter index is currently running at about 130,000.
Okay.
So it's near its flyway goal, but most of those birds are still in Mexico. As I mentioned, you know, AHM drives your duck bag frameworks for the Fish and Wildlife Service, and that's liberal this year. I want to point out that, you know, the Service's Regs Committee met last week, and so we just got the formal notice of what the frameworks are on Monday. And we'll have a liberal season framework alternative to us, which allows up to 107 days, 7 ducks, 7 mallards, 2 hen mallards. We'll end up with a full season bag for pintail and a little bit of a bright spot for canvasback. We don't have that restricted season in there, so we've got the opportunity to recommend more simpler regs, more consistent stuff. Kind of a heads up on SCOP, their populations continue to decline as well. The Service is going to develop another one of those harvest strategies like we have for pintail and canvasback, and I would expect restrictions coming on SCOP by next year. So as I said, we'll make our specific duck season dates and duck season bag limits at your next meeting. And as I said earlier on the goose framework, things are doing quite well. White-fronted geese, estimated fall flight is about 510,000, which is over the objective of 300,000 in that flyway plan. So it's nice to see some real bright success, and we're recommending some increases in bag limit, actually higher than we've ever been. We've never had a four-bird bag limit on white fronts before. Another issue you'll hear about more, I think, in late August is this late-season hunt for small Canada geese, primarily Aleutian Canada geese. Those birds were endangered until 1991. In the late 70s, they numbered fewer than 1,000. We now estimate their population to be over 100,000, where they're descending on the north coast of California, where it's mostly private land, and it's quite an impact to those private landowners up there. So we're proposing a late-season hunt on private lands, February 24th to March 10th up there. And again, the branch season will recommend a 30-day season. And because we fought so hard to get the zones from the Fish and Wildlife Service last year when we had to go down to 15 days, I think we'd prefer to see separate seasons in those two zones. And one we've mentioned to you earlier, a recommendation to change the boundary in Northeast California. And that's already been picked up in the federal framework. And that's just a brief summary of status stuff. I showed you in June the California duck stamp for this year. This is the federal duck stamp for this year, also done by Sherry Russell. And with that, that's all I had. If you had any questions.
No.
You want to talk?
Just
go ahead, Mr. Commissioner Kelly.
I just want to remind you that I hope that you're going to bring back, when you bring back recommendations, maybe more than just one choice, because the ultimate decision is ours, and we like to have people realize that.
Yeah, the good news, you know, with a full framework, that there's lots more latitude. And certainly you can go shorter, but when you have a 107-day duck season possible, for example, with an ending date of the last Sunday in January, you know, your choices do get a little limited in terms of season dates, you know. But, you know. Did you have something particularly in mind, though, on a particular area?
He's not going to say it right now.
I'll let you know on the 25th.
Dan,
I'll talk
easy.
To you anytime. I mean, that's something that's of high interest to me, and I definitely want to, you know, talk to a lot of folks and come back with something that everybody would be happy with.
Yeah. The extra dark goose, you want to talk at all about that? I know you're going to have a discussion, but maybe we should inform the commissioners here.
Yeah. The current regulations for geese in the balance of state zone, the federal framework allows up to 4 dark geese, but no more than 3 white fronts. We have recommended last year, and you adopted a 3 white front limit. The frameworks were changed, and we went to 3 large Canada geese at the same time. The California Waterfowl Association is going to recommend that the large Canada goose bag limit be raised to 4. If that were to happen, then your dart goose, your goose limit in that balance of state zone would be 4 geese. And it doesn't get any simpler than that. Guy can shoot 4 geese, any stripe, any color. However, we expected that recommendation from CWA earlier than we got it. And it's not clear whether our environmental document will allow us to do that this year. I will be speaking with our attorney this afternoon on that topic. That's it. To your question.
Great.
Have to renotice it.
We're going to, just to let the public know that we're going to renotice the adoption of the regs, and it will take place on the 24th and not the 25th. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you, Dan.
24. I have 5 speaker cards. Bill Gaines, followed by Walt Manzel, followed by Fred Harpster.
3 minutes. Good morning, Mr. President, members of the commission, members of commission staff, as well as Department of Fish and Game staff. It's a pleasure to be here today. My name is Bill Gaines. I'm president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance. I am here today representing the Tulare Basin Wetlands Association. They have provided to me a petition that's been signed by 15 clubs representing 150 hunters that shoot down basically in Kern County, which is in the southern San Joaquin zone within California. They are requesting the commission to consider an earlier season opener for them. It would be a 102-day season. It would open Saturday, October 7th. It would close Sunday, October 29th, reopen again on November 11th, and close with the rest of the state on January 28th. Again, that would be a 102-day season, fully within the 107-day framework that has been offered by the Fish and Wildlife Service. I do not have any California Waterfowl Association positions to provide at this time. We have a board meeting on August 12th, and I will certainly provide you with CWA's recommendations for the upcoming season at the August 24th meeting in Santa Barbara. But again, today we do have a position, or a petition rather, signed by most of the clubs down in the Kern and Tulare County requesting that early season opener. I'd like to provide that to the commission today for your consideration over the course of the next few weeks, and I'll have a formal CWA position on that later this month.
Thank you very much.
I do, and I will provide that now.
Bill, what is their reason for wanting the opener early?
Mr. Rogers, the Tulare Basin historically was the largest contiguous wetland in the state, about 500,000 acres during a wet year, 80 miles from end to end, a tremendous wetland resource long before we changed the hydrology of California. Today, it has undergone the greatest percentage loss of wetland habitat, not only within California, which, as you probably know, has suffered the tremendous wetland losses statewide. It has suffered the greatest wetland loss anywhere in the nation. About 98% of the wetlands down in the Tulare Basin have been destroyed by California's changed hydrology. What they would like to do is open a little bit earlier. Traditionally, it's a historical wintering and staging area for pintail. Pintail, which are traditionally early migrators, they're starting their migration right now. There's some already in the Central Valley. So typically, they would go down to the Tulare Basin, and they would hold down there, many of them for the entire winter. Some of them would continue on to Mexico, and a few of them, of course, would turn around and come back to the Central Valley. But it is a critically important pintail wintering and staging area. And as you saw from Mr. Perry-Gary's slides just a few minutes ago, we continue to be concerned about pintail, although we did see an upspike the last couple of years that we're very, very pleased to see. We want to do all we can to provide habitat for them, not only up in their nesting areas up north, but also here in California, which winters about 60% of the continental pintail population. By giving them an early season or opener, what it basically does is it buys us 2 more weeks of wetland habitat. Those clubs down there that want to open up early, and again, the bulk of them do because the Tulare Basin Wetlands Association represents nearly all of them, it would allow them to flood up 2 weeks earlier, assuming that the statewide balance of the state opener is October 21st, and all indications are at this stage that's likely when the rest of the state will open, with the exception of the northeastern zone. We'd get flood up 2 weeks earlier down there, which would provide habitat for those early migrating pintail as well as some other birds as well. it would certainly allow them to get a crack at those birds earlier in the season. Sometimes, because of the limited habitat down there, they'll turn around and go back to the grasslands or come back up to the Sacramento Valley. So it provides habitat for the birds.
I'm assuming that CWA is going to have something to say about that because, in fact, CWA represents clubs that are further on down the road than those guys,
right.
Myself being one of those.
Right. I can tell you what the preliminary recommendation to the CWA board is by the Regulations and Traditions Committee. They did approve or recommend, if you will, to support the Tulare Basin Wetlands Association position on this. Again, that's subject to the full board.
So they're assuming there is no impact to the clubs further downstream?
The Regulations and Traditions Committee has representatives on it from throughout the state, and there are several representatives from the Southern California zone, and they did not take exception to it, at least at the R&T level anyway.
Okay. I'd be interested to hear their comments.
I'll be more than happy to provide you with the details on the 24th. Yeah. Thank you very much. Now, quick question for Mr. Fisher. You wanted me to provide an update on the SHARE program. I can do that later. I can do that now. It does have to do with the two-week late season goose hunt up in Del Norte and Humboldt County.
It's up to the chair.
I understand, but he's the one that requested it. I'll ask Mike.
We'll wait.
Okay, that's fine.
Walt Manziel, followed by Fred Harpster, followed by Ted Romo.
Good morning, President Flores, members of the commission. I'm Walt Manziel, representing the California Rifle and Pistol Association. We may have some more recommendations like Mr. Gaines with respect to the general duck seasons around the state, but we have taken a position to support the proposal for the special Aleutian goose hunt late February, early March in Del Norte County. We have written new letters setting out our concerns in a couple of points and offering to recruit volunteers if the department wishes to help to oversee any part of that hunt that we could make a success out of it. It is a new page in the book for us in waterfowl management here in California, and we're very anxious to see that it goes well, and we'll do the best we can. Thank you.
Thank you, Walt.
Commissioners, Fred Harcher is my name, from Morro Bay. I'm representing the Black Mat Group. I'd like to thank you for last year's listening to us over Hunter and I Hunter conflict and finally working it out, and everything worked very well. Mr. Rogers recommended that we get our shooting time back, and we went from 8 o'clock to 7 o'clock, and that worked out very well, and we had no complaints. As far as I know, there was only 3 minor infractions in Morro Bay all season, a couple for over shell limit and one for unsigned duck stamp or something. Mr. Cognizini's here, and he did a lot of patrolling there, and there might be another question to that if not. Anyway, I'm here mostly for a recommendation for our for season for this year and for the future, and it looks like we're going to get a 30-day season back. We'd like to stay with a split season with Humboldt County also, and our recommendation is we'd like to start on the second Sunday in November and run continuous for the season. And that's what we're recommending to do. So it'll day will change every year, but it'll be just the second Sunday is what we'd like. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming all the way.
Ted Romo, followed by Mandy Davis.
Good morning. My name is Ted Romo. I'm out of Eureka, California, and I'm down here representing the Humboldt Bay area and the North Coast Waterfowl Association up there, the small little chapter that we've started many years ago. I'd like to address the topic of Humboldt Bay's black brant hunting season for 2006. And by the way, I did send some information to Mr. Carlson in a letter, and approximately 100 different hunters that signed the petition asking for these information that we're going to give you. We're requesting the 2006 hunting season's dates for Humboldt Bay Management North Coast Zone be reinstated similar to the 1998 to 2004 period that ran 30 consecutive days between November 10th and December 9th. This period falls well within the guidelines of the Pacific Black Brant Management Plan and the Federal Register Framework Migratory Bird Hunting Regulations for Black Brant. Now, due to the wonderful slides that Dan was able to show, I wish I had his abilities, you can see that there was an increase in the black brant population. And the Federal Register Framework mandates that the Pacific black brant seasons do not exceed December 15th. So as members of the North Coast Chapter of California Waterfowl Association, we are requesting that a 30-day brant season be reinstated from November 10th, okay, to December 9th for Humboldt Bay with a two-bird bag limit. This period falls well within the guidelines of the Flyway Management Plan. And again, we thank you for this consideration of this matter and be happy to answer any questions that any of you might have at this time.
If we had to tweak it just a little bit, I mean, what date does the 10th fall on?
I think it's a Wednesday or Thursday.
A Wednesday or Thursday.
It varies.
In order to preserve the split season, like let's say 5 days as opposed, I don't know what currently it's, you're looking at 2 or 3 day?
I think it's a two day split. It would start on the 10th, and I think they would start on the 13th.
Okay.
And that keeps the season split and gives us options to work throughout the future.
Okay. Very good.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mandy Davis.
Mandy Davis, Morro Bay. As you will note from my card, I'm representing a plethora of individuals. EcoSlow, Slow Coast Alliance, Sierra Club, Serene, Citizens of Morro Bay, and Los Osos. You might wonder why those individuals are not here. If you will recall last year, when we attended the meetings, and there were quite a few of us, we asked for some changes in the hunting regulations. At that point in time, there was so much interest in this, and there were so many people that felt so strongly about those changes, that you indicated that you would have a meeting in San Luis Obispo Memorial Bay this year. You have reneged on that promise, and people have not been able to attend because of that. Since that time, because of the Commission's inability to be able to even realize that the compromise that we were asking for, which was a reduction in days in territory, was not acceptable to you. And in response, you actually changed the regulations to be better for the hunters. Some changes have happened in the community, and those changes are these. We are now a united front. There is no compromise that is acceptable to any of us. We are all, every single one of us, including all of the people that signed the petitions, the 40,000-plus people that I represent, asking for a complete ban of waterfowl hunting in Morro Bay National Estuary. This is the only acceptable thing that we will go for. So people can't show up at this. They may be able to show up at the Santa Barbara meeting. They may be able to represent their own concerns. But I am here speaking for all of those individuals, and this is something that is important to all of us. Those concerns are not just biological, which we indicated. Those concerns are economic. Those concerns are public safety. Those concerns are public nuisance-oriented. You have two relatively decent-sized cities, a state park, a marina, a natural history museum right on the edge of this estuary, and to continue to allow hunting on this estuary is quite honestly an abomination. It is antiquated and it needs to change. Those changes may come hard and they may not come immediately, but guaranteed the numbers of people that are going to ask for an end to hunting on the Morro Bay estuary will increase, and eventually you're going to have to pay attention to us. So you have the information from last year, all of the petitions, all the letters, and you will have more added to that. But understand, there is no compromises being asked for now. And if you want people to sit down at the table, that's probably something that isn't going to really happen, because the reality is we've done that in the past. We've been reasonable in the past. We've asked for compromises, and basically you've shot us down and ignored us. So please put a meeting in the San Luis Obispo area on the agenda for next year. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mandy, let me just comment real quick. As you know, I went to Morro Bay once on a little vacation and ran into some community folks and some city council members and some environmental leaders who expressed concerns to me about hunting on the estuary. As you know from that, there was a request to prevent further hunting of the black brant on the estuary. I mean, as you know, I was involved in all of that. We all know that. I wasn't committed to stopping or advocating anything at the time. I thought it really needed to be examined. We had the hearing in Morro Bay, as you know. It was a very divisive and polarized hearing. And I thought there was enough evidence that we should move the boundaries and maybe restrict the days. The majority of the commission decided there wasn't enough evidence, 4-1, if I remember, and I hate to show how impotent I am publicly. And then the community was still divided, and the only reason I'm disagreeing with you only about one thing. Then the waterfowl package was put before us, which I voted for completely because there was no reason to oppose the waterfowl package. I had lost on the black brant border issue. But the point that I'm going to disagree with you on is what I remember saying, and I remember the commission agreeing to, was if there was new information and new facts and new figures and new reason to bring this up again, we would have another hearing in Morro Bay on the issue if there was an overwhelming amount of evidence to show that there was more reasons to do this. Otherwise, we'd just be back there again with the same crowds yelling the same things, and the vote would probably be the same. So I'm not disrespecting your passion or your comments. I'm just saying, unless there's real new stuff, then there's no reason for us to do it, is what I told Andrew Christie that and all those kind of folks. So no disrespect to the 4,000 people who signed or the 40,000 people who signed a petition, but this is a voting commission. And unless there's new things, the black brant guys did a better job at showing their case than what the other folks did, and that's how democracy works. So I'm just saying, I didn't want you to think that we lied to you about saying we'd have a meeting. We said to you, bring us new stuff. If it looks like we can change the opinion of the majority of the commission, let's look at it. But otherwise, we need to move on with this stuff and not go revisit the same polarized community. And that's all. That's as I remember it happening.
Thank you for your comments, sure. Mr. Hatoy. But you mentioned that's how democracy works. Well, if you want to talk about how democracy works, a handful of folks that want to continue to do something that is compared to an entire community and tens of thousands of people, I wouldn't call that particularly democratic.
I'm not disagreeing with you on the passionate nature or the numbers in which you're representing. I'm just trying to say to you that all these folks who care need to come up with new facts and figures if they really believe that this commission should change the regulations. That's all I'm saying. All I'm saying is you guys did a great job, but it didn't work. And to go visit it again, it just would be foolish for me to make the motion because we'd lose, and it'd be foolish for all of that community to get so divided.
I might weigh in on this as well, take a little heat. Yeah. Mr. Kellogg has one too, I guess. But I think it's important for you to understand where I am on this as well. I agree entirely with what Mr. Hatoy said, mm-hmm. although I am a person who you're gonna be hard pressed to get me to remove rights from someone for philosophical reasons, not technical reasons. In other words, what you need to do is exactly what Mr. Hatoy said. You need to bring health and safety issues, some issue that would be the sort of issue that this commission would actually operate on in order to take the rights of one user group over another. That is something that's really, something we really try to avoid. It's kind of like the tyranny of the majority if, in fact, you represent the majority. a lot of us have fought for minority interests throughout our society. And I think that if you put yourself philosophically in a different shoe, you might come to the same conclusion. So what you need to do, all we're saying is we're not saying that you can't get what you want. You need to go about it in a non-philosophical way, in a technical way.
And I did hear that, and I heard that the last time. We did give you a preponderance of information about non-target species being shot, about safety issues, and these were not necessarily even philosophical, about public nuisance issues, about economic issues. These are all viable arguments, and we gave you plenty of information on that. Mandy, so this is not purely philosophical.
They were anecdotal at best.
Mr. Chairman.
No, they were not.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead. Mr. Kellogg.
I'm a little perturbed that us as a commissioner going back and revisiting something on a decision that we already made based on one person's opinion that doesn't agree with it. If we were going to do this, every meeting we have, somebody disagrees with the decision we made, and we might as well go back and have marathon sessions like you did last night and revisit all these issues. The issue's over with and dead, we listen to Paul's opinion every meeting, and we don't go back and discuss it for over and over and over again. So just because somebody has an opinion that didn't agree with us. So
Mr. Kellogg, this is not one person's opinion. I represent thousands of people, and I really resent your saying that.
Well, we got people that claim to represent thousands of people.
Well, you have letters in files that say, and from Sierra Club, from Eco Slow, from Slow Coast Alliance, from the city of Los Osos, from the city of Morro Bay.
Thank you.
Excuse
me,
this is not one person.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andy.
Okay. At this time, I'd like to introduce Mr. Ryan Broderick, the director of the Department of Fish and Game.
President Flores, members of the Commission, Fish and Game Commission, thank you very much for allowing me to use this venue to announce our Warden of the Year. As you're aware, the determinations you make, both in regulations, statutes, and response to public comment, you have a difficult and daunting task, and yet when those regulations are adopted, when you ask for compliance or understanding of the effectiveness of what you adopt and deliberate on, one of the critical links to that response from the department back to you is the role of law enforcement. The regulations you develop to manage and conserve California's diverse natural resources can only serve the intended purpose when they're enforced, frankly. And they're enforced by the Department of Fish and Game as wildlife protection officers. It's a division with a long history, and I won't go through the numbers, not a lot of them, but effective in their task. Whether the objective is protection of habitat, protection of threatened or endangered species, protection of our hunting and fishing heritage, continuance of the unique North American wildlife management model that we have, which is unique to the world, it's predicated on an investment in conservation. It's predicated on a series of rules and regulations. It's predicated on using hunting and fishing as a management tool. But most fundamentally, it's predicated on that wildlife or a public trust resource, not the property of the realm or property of the king. Unique role. It's a critical role. Critical role in a state approaching 37 million people. In a diverse and beautiful landscape with very diverse views of how and when we should intercede in the conservation, management, and preservation of fish and wildlife. It's critical that we have a strong law enforcement presence and capacity. It's critical to ensure that the print that we put on paper at your direction actually becomes reality on the ground. So it's my pleasure, and I once again greatly appreciate the Commission allowing us to use this venue to announce the Wildlife Law Enforcement Officer of the Year, Mr. Todd Tognazzini.
Yes.
Dawes had a long career with the Department of Fish and Game, 28 years. Started his career in 1978. He's done a variety of tasks, but I want to tell you that across the board, whether it be the hands-on, i.e. defensive tactics and firearms, whether it be doing environmental investigations, whether it's dealing with private landowners and developing relationships of stewardship and trust, whether it's mentoring officers in the Department of Fish and Game, he has done it all. He's done it exceptionally. And it's my pleasure this year to recognize Todd as Officer of the Year. He will be part of the exchange program we have with the other Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. And you can never bring a warden to the dais and recognize him without recognizing his wife, Chris. Those nights that get called out are guaranteed to be the anniversary, the birthday. They create more migraines. The wardens create more migraines, I guarantee you, than any other factor in a spouse or significant other's life experience. He also has Tamara and Kyle and Amy, his daughters, which obviously have to put up with the intrigue and enchantment of being on call 24/7. So to Todd and to his family, I want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart, and once again to the commission, thank you for allowing us to use this venue to give a little glimpse to the public recognition that frankly, there's a whole cast of officers out there in the field that do a nearly impossible job on a day-to-day basis, and Todd is emblematic of that. Todd?
I don't really have anything prepared. I guess to quote Lou Gehrig, I feel extremely lucky, we all have a tremendously invested interest in wildlife resources for this state, and to be honored amongst my peers and amongst people that I have a tremendous respect for is quite a thing that never expected. Really, you work every day in your interest in wildlife resources, and you hope that you do the right thing out there. And you know that one of the unique things about our constituency, our true constituency out there, is that wildlife resources don't have a voice. And so whether it's something, a drag mark beside the road, a shell casing that sits in the dirt that you spot that takes you to that protection element, those are the types of things that we all work toward and work for. So I want to thank you very much for this recognition. Certainly my family, my wife, and director, and all my chain of command, and Mr. Flores and the rest of the commission, thank you very much.
Todd, a question for you, if I may. Are you, by any chance, related to the Tognazzini family, farming family?
Well, it's ironic, but originally there were two large Tognazzini families that settled in northern Santa Barbara County in the late 1800s, and the big farming family is actually not related to us. My dad was a school
Victor at all.
May be distant cousins, but my father's done a bunch of genealogy way, way back. But we've been both on my mother's side in California since the 1850s, and on my father's side, both families ironically homesteaded under the California Homestead Act. So
yours is a very celebrated name in those counties. My hat's off to your family.
Yeah. Now, well, actually, it could not to be outdone by the director, we actually have our own resolution to present. So if I could get Todd to come up here and join us up here on the dais, we'll gather around and take a picture. You know, I wanted Ryan had touched on some stuff about Todd being away and how away from home and
Chris,
come on up as well. And so I'm going to read some of these whereases we have, but I have the distinct pleasure of actually hunting with Todd, and I can tell you the guy's a stud when it comes to climbing hills. He's a mountain goat, and he's a consummate gentleman. I also know his brother, and their great contribution to the community down there. And our resolution says that whereas you, Todd Tognazzini, are experiencing a productive and highly successful career with the Department of Fish and Game, starting as a wildlife enforcement seasonal aide in Port Hueneme in 1978, then as a reserve warden in San Luis Obispo County then as a marine fisheries biologist in Long Beach in 1982, and then as a game warden in 1984, graduating from the Law Enforcement Academy as a class outstanding officer and an academic award winner. So you started early with that stuff. During your career at the Department of Fish and Game, you became an esteemed ambassador to California's diverse stakeholder groups and gave unselfishly to protect our fish and wildlife resources, both those abundant and scarce. And whereas you have regularly assisted as a crew member on one of the department's ocean-going patrol boats, developing a keen sense of sport and commercial marine enforcement. And whereas you further provided your expertise to your community as a part-time lecturer at Cal Poly State University San Luis Obispo in natural resource management. And you have previously been honored by the Department of Fish and Game as Officer of the Year for the Central Coast Region in 1997 and received the Hunter Education Instructor Award in 1998. So now, therefore, be it resolved that the California Fish and Game Commission hereby recognizes and honors you, Todd Tognazzini, as California Fish and Game Officer of the Year for 2005. Congratulations, Todd.
Thank you.
Kind of move this over.
Well, look at all this place is packed.
We will.
Thank you, everyone. So let's.
Yeah, because we got to talk.
Our next item. Okay.
We're going to go to item number 3, presentation by Drew Bohan, Executive Policy Officer, California Ocean Protection Council, regarding discussion of their MPA monitoring efforts.
Thank you very much. That's a tough act to follow, a true California hero. My name is Drew Bowen, and I'm the Executive Policy Officer for the Ocean Protection Council, and I was appointed in May by Governor Schwarzenegger after spending a year at the governor's office in the Cabinet Department, and I promised John I'd keep this very brief, but I wanted to share with you what our role is at OPC relative to what you spent all day working on yesterday on the MLPA process. The OPC was created in response to the two ocean commissions, the Pew Commission and the U.S. Commission, and the suggestions they made about how to improve ocean governance. We are made up of our council as Secretary Chrisman, Secretary Adams at Cal EPA, and the state controller, who who is, state lands chair, who is currently the controller, Steve Wesley, as well as two legislators. The two current appointees are Senator Kuehl and Assemblyman Nava. And one of our principal mandates is to try to bridge the gap between the tremendous science that California produces, particularly marine science, and the progressive decision-making that you and other policymakers up in Sacramento make. And what I wanted to talk a little bit about is monitoring and what our plan is. The governor's budget that he signed recently has a substantial amount of money for the MLPA putting it into practice. And in particular, there's money there that will be used for monitoring. There's $8 million that has been set aside for MLMA and MLPA that the Ocean Protection Council is required to come up with a plan for. We're working with Sankey and others at the department to do just that. And we expect at our October 26th meeting, we'll have the plan approved by our council, and then it needs to be submitted to the legislature, and then 30 days thereafter, we can spend the money. It will be used on a number of different activities, but again, I wanted to focus on some of the comments you all made yesterday and questions you had about monitoring and what our plan is looking like. We expect to do two things. The first is work with the department to make sure that we do monitoring so that whatever package you end up adopting, we will have sufficient funds in place and infrastructure in place to collect the data that will support and determine the answers we need to the questions about the efficacy of these areas. So that's the first task, and I'd love to be able to promise that we've got sufficient funds in the bank to do this monitoring over the next couple of decades. Can't do that, but in response to Mr. Hattoy's comment yesterday, I think we're a little better off than just looking for our next rent check. And I think if we do a good job, we've got a motivated legislature and governor to assure that funding is in place to do that properly. The second function is we're in the process right now of creating a monitoring institution that will perform the function of taking the data that's gathered, having IT professionals put it in a usable format so that the folks that were in the room yesterday and others in the state that are interested, and in particular you folks, will have access to that data. There will be a communications function as well to coordinate that. But we really see this as being a two-way street, and not the function of this entity will not be to produce data and put it out there just for the sake of the science, but in fact to answer the questions you need answered. So we see this institution working closely with you to tease out what questions you have as you need to make management decisions, and then going out and trying to find those answers. One other point on monitoring is, jumping back to that for a moment, we're hoping to build what's already been built in terms of going out there and gathering data, and that is we've got universities that are involved in this effort, we've got private nonprofits involved, and we also want to help promote more involvement of the fishermen in those communities that are the folks on the water, know the status of the areas where they go every day better than probably just about anyone, and integrate them into the process of data gathering as we move forward. So that's all I wanted to share with you, is just our role and how we're hoping to make sure that effort is done properly in the coming years.
Mm-hmm. Questions, if I may? What is the budget, the operating budget of the Ocean Protection Council?
It's pretty modest. It is, I wish our budget folks were here today. I don't have an exact figure for you, because the way we're structured is to be very, very lean and mean and not have a staff. So we don't have any particular staff. What we have is folks at the Resources Agency that we sort mm-hmm. of share, and then several people at the Ocean Conservancy who devote substantial chunks, or in some cases all of their time, to Ocean Protection Council functions, mm-hmm. but that's also within the Conservancy budget. So I'm not sure I can give you a precise answer.
Okay. In no range, approximately?
Well, I think it's about $300,000.
Okay. About half of what we are. Question. How does what, Sankey, if you would comment on this as well. Yesterday, we talked a lot about the extraordinary amount of money it's going to take. We didn't get into the specifics to do monitoring and enforcement, the MLPA. all of us, we've talked about phasing, we've talked about all kinds of ideas to try to make it so that the MLPA that we end up with is doable and doesn't further diminish the almost wheels-off nature of the Department of Fish and Game. How are the monies that you guys have control over and seem to be able to get relating to this specific problem that we have? This commission, well, this commissioner, and many of my colleagues, I would imagine, are extremely sensitive to not wanting to lay on the department something that is going to make a horrible situation worse and literally turn the lights out on the department. Put in place something that is paper only and is a sham. That's something we don't want to do. So
sure.
How does what you're doing relate to solving that problem? Because the monies sound pretty good.
Well, let me back up a little bit, because I think the answer to that is less exactly what we're doing at OPC and a larger question of how the department's been funded through the recent budget. And I won't even attempt to try to explain what I know Sankey and his staff are working on right now, but my understanding is the budget provided two things. It provided a chunk of money, several chunks of money to be used for various functions to do what you're talking about, and I described one of them that we're going to probably focus largely on monitoring, and I understand that's only a sliver of the whole package.
On monitoring what?
Monitoring the MPAs.
Okay.
All of them?
Well, for right now, we've got our focus is on the efforts that are being done to put together a plan that focuses on the Central Coast. And yes, all of those that would be in the Central Coast, but not the entire state at this point.
In other words, this current thing that we're just working on right now, I'm not certain if what you're talking about relates to what we are in process of deciding yesterday and on the 15th. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Those exact MPAs and reserves and parks and whatever.
That's right. But I think also looking forward and looking at the larger issue of there's a process to replicate this over the statewide.
Indeed.
And getting an institution in place and a framework in place that we can then use in those places as you perform your functions.
Yeah, because where I'm going, what I'm getting at here is that there doesn't seem to be what I've seen yet. I mean, there may be, but I just haven't seen it yet. The monies to do what we've been asked to do. That does not seem to be on the table. It may be on the table for this year, but there's, you know, the way budgets go, of course, there's never anything promised. Okay,
right.
Having said that, to what extent do you feel that you're in the process of allocating monies for for how this thing was all put together for the Pew and, you know, all their larger concerns? What percentage of the monies that you guys have control over, if you will, what percentage of those monies are going to be targeted towards the Central Coast MLPA network?
I feel like I'm evading your questions, and I really don't intend it to be that way, but we haven't worked out exactly where we think all the money ought to go. We've been given a fairly broad charge from the legislature. Here's money to be spent broadly on these activities, and we're just in the process now of evaluating that. But I did want to point out, in addition to the monies that OPC has been given discretion to spend on some of these sort of institutional issues over time, and some of the data collection specifically on monitoring, there's also substantial funds in the budget for staff to be used just for the MLPA process, in part in recognition of what you've outlined and what happened in Santa Barbara and so forth. So what I can't answer is exactly how what's in the budget links up precisely with
understand,
what
and I don't mean to be putting you
no,
on
no,
the
I understand.
Spot. What I'd like to get across to you, however, and to everyone else on the Ocean Protection Council, is how, and not that they don't understand this, but how absolutely critical it is that the department be funded properly for enforcement and monitoring of the MLPA. Otherwise, what we're doing is we're putting at risk, and that we know what that is, and that we know that we, the commission, know that that's in place. Because if we don't get that, we're probably not going to get an MLPA.
Absolutely.
And that's critical. In other words, if somebody on that council wants to spend money with their, and I don't mean to suggest anyone wants to do this, with their favorite university or their favorite little project someplace else, that is probably not a good idea.
Understood. I think it's quite clear to us, and we recently adopted on June 8th a strategic plan, and MLPA and MLMA are both featured components of that. There are other things in it, obviously, but I don't think there's anyone involved with OPC that doesn't acknowledge that this is one of the critical state efforts we're involved in.
Thank you.
Mr. Sankey.
Yes. Because I think you asked me a question. Do you still want me?
Would you state your name for the record?
Yeah, this is Sankey Mastrup, Deputy Director, and I have Gary Stacey, the Marine Regional Manager, next to me. He's my heavy. Your question is a very good one. As I hinted, and I'm going to cover it in more detail under the department's budget update, the administration and the legislature was indeed very generous. They finally heard the needs. If you want to do this, you got to put up some funds. In total, the budget includes 56 new positions for the department, but it's for a bunch of different things, including Marine Life Protection Act, Marine Life Management Act, halibut bottom trawl implementation, and miscellaneous, for a total of $19 million new dollars. The $8 million that was put in the OPC's budget is part of that. That's 8 of the 19. It is contract dollars, though. It's not personnel dollars. So what I'm getting at, there is a maze or a complex mix of persons and dollars we have to work out in a plan, and the legislation has asked us and the OPC to craft this plan to implement part of its monitoring both MLMA and MLPA challenges. We don't know, getting specifically to what you put him on the spot, we won't really know where, what, and how much various things are going to cost until we start solidifying the reserve network, and then we start figuring out what are we actually going to try and monitor, and that's related to the goals and objectives for the network and the specific reserve. So we will be learning more and more here in the next few months exactly what our challenge is and how we phase it in. We can't, you can contract some of the work working with some institutions, including universities, where there may be research challenges that they may be the best ones for the job, and you would, for example, contract. And then there may be ongoing projects that the department would allocate some of the personnel, permanent persons, to that. So this is a huge challenge. Gary can elaborate, but he's got this is a 40% increase or 30% increase in their base funding and personnel. So it's a big shot in the arm. We were going to come back to you sometime in the near future and show you the org chart, present and now this, and how we're going to and what we're going to implement. So we'll be working with the OPC specifically on this $8 million. It's actually one-time money that we can spend for 3 years or earmarked for 3 years. So that's something we'll be coming back to you with the details as we develop it.
Thank you, Sankey. I think the take-home message from me personally, and I think there are other commentaries here from other commissioners, is that it would be a real tragedy if we went through all this Blue Ribbon Task Force work, all of the work the department has done and ourselves on the MLPA Central Coast packages, and get to a position where the department cannot stand in front of this commission and say that they have the manpower and the budget to do what we have just asked them to do. Because I don't believe that the commission will then vote to go forward unless those monies are in place. So if you know anybody, that's probably a pretty important take-home message. And I'm perfectly willing to take whatever political heat anyone wants to lay on me. I'm not going to vote for it if the money's not there.
Right. And can I just add, one of the things, and I've agreed with Mr. Rogers about this the whole way, but one of the things that I've been saying the last few meetings, and I think Sankey just confirmed it and Drew just confirmed it, and that's why I'm a little nervous about Mr. Rogers when you say this every meeting, The money is there this year, and who knows what will be there next year. And let's not give people a fear that somehow this isn't going. What it does is it feeds into those that believes it can't be done. I want the governor and the resources secretary and the legislature to hear from me loud applause for what they did this year. And I want them to understand that as far as this one commissioner goes, I'm extremely thankful for the money they put into the OPC, to the department, for the staffing of the wardens, for the monitoring, for the enforcement. And for the first time, I think all of these groups are working together. Many times in the past, we've had philosophical discussions about a type of policy we'd like to implement, and there's no money there. That's not happening anymore. And while it is happening this year, I think we should support it, applaud it, shine light on it, and give political and, you know, whatever, cover and support for it. So I just want to throw that in there. I don't want to keep talking about gloom and doom over what we're doing right now, because there isn't any of that going on.
Bob, I completely agree with what you're saying.
Okay.
Absolutely agree. I have not been told, nor have you, I believe, by the department, that they have the money and the positions and the manpower to do what we're about to ask them to do. Now, we haven't asked them yet.
Right.
All I'm suggesting is that when we do ask them that,
yep,
they are fully aware of the fact that they have to be ready with a monitoring and enforcement plan and cost of implementing it.
Right.
And what you're suggesting is that you believe that through the good efforts of the legislature and the various constituents and the governor's office that we have managed to put that together for this year. I am delighted that I hear that that's true. I wait for the department to tell me that, in fact, it is true.
Right.
Richard?
Okay.
If I may for a moment. It would seem that clarifying our role with the Ocean Protection Council as well, how we work together on this, is appropriate. And could I suggest that perhaps the Marine Resources Committee meet with a joint meeting and with the department to assure that this message is delivered in person?
Yeah.
I trust that the two of you represent.
That's a good idea.
We've never been asked to do that, so we would be delighted to do that.
A broad spectrum.
That's because Commissioner Augustuson always has all the good ideas.
Thanks, Bob. But I think that way these communications can be expressed directly. The concerns that we have as a commission and the role that we're finding ourselves in can be expressed. And I'm sure people are hearing that, but that would be a more direct communication. Also, I wanted to ask you quickly about the event in October, the World's Ocean. I'd heard about it. Is there a role for the commission to play in that event? Should we plan to attend?
Absolutely.
September?
Okay. In September. Let me just jump back to your previous point. I think it's an excellent one. We welcome it. We will do that. We haven't done it in the formal way you've described, but as you might imagine, we've heard the concerns that you've just expressed this morning and have been doing our level best to respond to those and come up with a credible plan that will have a price tag that we can all look at and share with those who decide on whether that amount is appropriate or not in the out years. So we're working diligently on that. As far as the California and the World Ocean Conference, it begins on the Sunday, I believe it's the 17th or perhaps the 18th of September, and it runs for through Wednesday. And absolutely, all the commissioners are invited to participate. There are various ways to participate, both in terms of panels that we'll be having, and I believe there are about 60 of those panels with five or six panelists on each. There's plenty of room for involvement. We also have plenary sessions where there will be speakers. We're expecting Leon Panetta to be one of the speakers. We've invited Christine Todd Whitman to be one of the speakers, Admiral Lautenbacher, those types of folks. The governor's invited. He has a obviously very filled calendar, but we're deeply hopeful he'll be able to make it as well. So it should be a terrific conference, and we'd be delighted to have you involved in ways.
I know a couple of the presenters have mentioned, had mentioned it to me, and I was very interested in both attending, but also for the rest of the commission, because I think as we're jumping off into this deep water with the Marine Life Protection Act, understanding what's going on out there worldwide. I mean, you have presenters worldwide attending on the various marine protected areas in other nations, what pitfalls they've had, what they've learned through that process, because I think we sit in this room hearing testimony, but yet we haven't done it yet, and there's a lot to learn from others.
Yeah, I was planning on being there.
Okay.
Well, then let's talk offline about
what
the options are and how to best integrate those that are interested in the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thanks for being here today, too.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
I have one public speaker on this, Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. We believe calling these marine protected areas is a misnomer. These are no fishing zones. And we are still asking the question on how does this protect the habitat or the resource. All it does is punish fishermen. There is no way to keep in an area closed to fishing will protect the habitat. Fishing does not destroy habitat. Not in these areas. No fishing in these areas has ever done that. And why attack fishermen for past management errors and flaws? Well, that's so you don't have to admit that you failed. There are no baseline studies. We failed already. There's no criteria for failure, so it's a failure. They say that they have $8 million, but over here, Zonkey Master said, he has no idea how much it'll cost. That might be double the money you need already. So without knowing how much it costs, we're really talking about nothing. Now, data. Let's talk about data. D-A-T-A. We're team data. Data. D-A-T-A. Well, we know that figures lie and liars figure. You get away from the numbers, you'll have a better chance of achieving our goals. Right now, the goals are still obscure. Now, we've already been told that these no fishing zones, that any benefits will be canceled out by fishing compaction. And how does closing an area to fishing protect the resource from failed federal policies like the Mammal Protection Act? It doesn't. How does closing an area to fishing protect it from the otter fraud? No. How does closing an area of fishing protect it from one of the worst scourges upon the face of the earth, unethical researchers, the grant-sucking parasites that you want to give this $8 million to manufacture data? The whole thing is ill-conceived, and what we lack here is honesty, integrity, or any ethical standards. We should revise this, and instead of going forward, why don't we learn from the past? No one has done their homework. We've been taught many lessons, but we're not being allowed to learn. This is a scourge. Along with the questions of how does this protect the habitat, we have also not been answered how and why do you continue to promote aquaculture when we know this scourge has devastated the natural ecology of our state. Many species have been devastated by the genetically altered hybrid species that are being introduced into our state through aquaculture. But will you take on this very important question? Oh, no. We're going to attack the people that can least defend themselves, the fishermen.
Thank you, Mr. Weakland. Kind of looks like Congress out there. When you see it on TV. Oh. One speaker and the chamber's empty.
Moving along to item four. Michael,
item four.
Okay. Department update on the pelagic organism decline in the San Francisco estuary. Giving the presentation today is Chuck Armour, a manager with the department's Bay Delta branch. I believe it's still called Bay Delta branch, but it could have changed.
Mr. President, members of the board, I really appreciate, or the commission rather, I really appreciate the opportunity to make this presentation today. You're going to get the abbreviated Reader's Digest version of the story. There's a lot in it. There's a lot going on. And as you may be aware, this whole issue is central to a lot of the water development decisions that are being talked about in the Delta and in the state right now. And so this whole thing is kind of stage center. The area we're going to be talking about, yep, is focused right in the Delta and down in the Susan Bay. This is where the problem is centered. Oop, how do I advance? There. To put the problem in perspective for you, in 2004, at the end of 2004, we were looking at some of our long-term monitoring. This is work that's been done by the IEP, which is a collaborative group of six federal and three state agencies that's been doing monitoring and research out in the Delta since 1980. And we noticed a steep step decline in four of our pelagic species. These are species that live in the water column. These are all young of the year or small fish that, in some cases, it only lived to be 1 to 3 years old. And you can see there's been a rather dramatic drop-off in all these species. And in a couple cases, and especially the striped bass, you can see that this is actually a long-term decline. When we went back and looked at our data, we kind of summarized it into three categories of what could be causing the problem. We list these as the usual suspects: exotic species, water project operations, and toxics. And I need to give you kind of a brief history of what's been going on. In 2004, we identified the problem. In 2005, we briefed all of the directors. They told us to go forth and put a work plan together to get at the problems, and we have done that. That work plan was subjected to independent peer review. We then got that work plan funded and implemented in 2005, and it was funded an additional $1.8 million, and this was on top of about the $15 to $16 million that IEP was already spending on monitoring in the system. In October, a group of both agency and outside experts got together and synthesized all the information we had pulled together to date. This was presented at a public workshop. And then this was also subjected to an outside independent peer review of that report. We took the recommendations of those peer reviewers, prepared a work plan for 2006 and 2007, and in January the directors told us to get moving and get that going. We currently have a budget for this additional work on this of about $3.7 million. This effort's overseen by an interagency team of folks, what we call the pod management team, that represent both state and federal agencies, and includes people from the CalFed Bay Delta Authority. Quickly, I want to run you through a kind of a conceptual diagram of how we're looking at the Delta, and that'll help you kind of put some of the pieces together here. We have fish abundance, which is basically predicated on prior fish abundance, which is moderated by mortality, which needs food sources to make it happen. All of this is happening within what we call a physical and chemical habitat. The food sources, those are moderated, or their availability is moderated by a number of things out in the Delta that we'll get to in a few moments. So let's talk about habitat. When we talk about habitat, we're looking at what salinity, turbidity, contaminants, temperature, toxic algae. There's a whole bunch of stuff that comprises the physical and chemical habitat out there for these species. One way we've taken a look at this is we've taken a lot of our data of where fish are found, created a model in terms of what salinity and temperatures they're found at, and water clarity. Then we take all of our other data that we have from long-term monitoring in terms of what water quality existed, and say what kind of habitat existed for these fish, and more importantly, has there been a decline in the last 4 to 5 years coincident with the decline we saw in the species? And in the case in the fall period, we see that indeed this has been the case, that the habitat for these species, as based on this kind of pelagic habitat of temperature and water clarity, has dropped off. And this is consistent with some work being done by some other folks. We ask what may be some of the issues with toxics in the Delta. In 2005, some of the highlights from some of our work is we have seen some changes in use patterns. Mainly we've seen more pyrethrins being used, pyrethroids. In recent years, we started some bioassay work. We found some toxicity to the invertebrates, but it wasn't great, or it wasn't a large amount enough for us to chase back to a specific cause. And also, we have a toxic blue-green algae out there, Microcystis, which the amount of that out there has increased between 2004 and 2005. So looking at mortality, I want to focus on today just on the entrainment issue. As you know, the state diverts somewhere between 10 and over 60% of the fresh water going into the system to the south. And as part of that process, fish are taken in. So we looked at that and we said, what are some of the recent things that have changed there? Well, we found that, A, there's been less San Joaquin River flow, there's been a shift in the timing of the exports, and there's been a longer duration of the barriers that are put in the delta to facilitate some of this. So what can the effects of this be? Well, we looked at fish salvage, since this would be one indicator, and we saw that in the last about 4 to 5 years that there has been an increase in salvage, in the wintertime salvage, of all of the pod species I showed you, plus several others. The important thing here for Delta smelt is these are the spawning adults that are being taken. Now, this, we have had periods before then where this has occurred, but the interesting thing in this is a consistent trend across all species. It's consistent if you correct it for the amount of water pumped. And so we believe there is something going on here that we're pursuing a lot further. So we developed what we call our winter salvage hypothesis, which says that recent changes in operations and have led to an increase in the winter salvage of these fish, and this will impact these species. The question is, does it have a population impact? Some early statistical analysis says that it has a significant, albeit minor, role when looking at the long time series. Some newer work by Dr. Wim Kimmer has said that for larval delta smelt, there could actually be a fairly high take of a number of those diverted at the facilities. So jumping over to food sources, the phytoplankton, and both phytoplankton and zooplankton in this estuary, their numbers are a lot lower than what you see in a lot of other estuaries in the world. Both have shown long-term declines in this estuary, but for phytoplankton, we don't see a long-term decline. But for zooplankton, which is the food source for a lot of these small fish, there has been a decline in Susan Bay in the Western Delta. So how does this food availability get moderated before it gets to the fish? Well, we've got a new clam out there that came in about the mid-80s. And the question is, what effect will this have on things? And what we've seen with various researchers is that it's disrupted the food web in that it has been harvesting off the zooplankton before the fish can get to them. Just to highlight a couple things is that Wim Kimmer has seen that there's been a big change in the food web and how it worked, the relationships out there since the introduction of the clam. And we find that the prey occurrence, in other words, the zooplankton, is a good predictor of what delta smelt, how they survive over the course of the summer. So the role of the clam in all this is an active part of investigation right now, and we have about 6 different research efforts going on looking at this. So to give you the food web out there in the 1970s, we basically said we had phytoplankton, which fed zooplankton, which fed the small fish. In the 1980s, the clam came in, and you would think that since the copepods are being eaten by the clams, there'd be fewer fish, but that wasn't the case. And what we found was that we missed part of the food web, and that is that the detritus and bacteria are feeding ciliates, which allow for a number of large copepods to be there, so the fish number stayed up. What's different now? We have a new small copepod that's grazing on these things, and so thus there's less food going up into the fish component. We don't have a lot of information on this and this right now, and these are active areas of research. So we have 2 hypotheses. One that says we have Susan Bay, which is a nursery area for a lot of these species, that the food web has been disrupted there, and we have our winter salvage hypothesis that says we're taking more of the adults during the winter period. And we think these are linked by when you start looking at habitat and how exotic weeds play into this, we think this is going to stitch together in a whole picture. Now, I'm going to jump to where we're headed. I kind of left off some of the contaminant stuff. Our strategy for contaminants is that we're asking the question, is the water toxic? And to get at this, we are taking water samples from across the delta every month, and we're running bioassays with both fish and invertebrates. If any of those turn up toxic, then we will take that water, examine it for what's in it. Once we find the toxic constituents, then we'll go back to and try to find the sources of it and determine if there's a population-level impact. We'll do that by going back to all of the regional monitoring by the sent by the various water quality control boards and others that are doing monitoring. We'll be doing it by doing some dose response modeling. Other toxicity-related stuff we're doing is we're doing a lot of histopathology and biomarker analysis. This is a way of looking at individual fish, looking at their livers and other parts of them that give us an indication that they have encountered a toxic event in their life. It's like almost a cellular level of looking at them. And lastly, we're continuing the work to look at the microcystis to see what role this may have in it. Where we're headed this year and next year, we're expanding a lot of our narrative work. We're looking at a lot of the food web effects. For the first time, we're doing a screening across the delta on the fish to see if there's a disease problem out there. This hasn't been done before. We are going back and reevaluating and looking at the power plants in the delta and seeing what impact they maybe have, and we're doing this in a joint manner with the corporation, which owns the two large power plants out there. There is a lot of modeling going on to help us kind of understand what we know and what we don't know and how things may impact various things. And we're going to be doing a lot of what we call synthesis, which is bringing all this toxic data, the flow data, all these different pieces of data together, trying to put them together and understand them. And we're actually involving a lot of outside groups in this, and we will be actually expanding the circle of people who will be involved in this greatly this year. So your question might be, which of these things is causing it? Well, the answer is, it's probably going to be all three. There's no single smoking gun here. My guess is it's going to be a combination of any of these, and it may change by the species we're looking at, and it may even change by the life stage. And I don't think we're going to end up with a simple statistical test that's going to say it's this or it's this. What we're going to end up with is a weight of evidence type of situation that points us in that direction. Thank you.
If I may, I'm sure you're well aware that the impact on water projects could have a profound effect on the economy of the state of California.
Oh, our directors, actually, one thing I didn't mention is that all of the directors are very concerned about this, to the point where they actually agreed to have quarterly meetings to discuss this. I confer with my director often on this, and we have heard loud and clear, we need answers, we need them as quick as you can get to them. We have actually developed a process to move this information to them in an almost unprecedented rate. I mean, when we find something new, they know within a couple days. And so we're attempting to help them in getting to these decisions that they need to make for water. And so, yes, we're very cognizant of it. We're thinking about what can we do to make things better or to at least mitigate for some of the things going on. Those are very active parts of our discussion.
Yeah, because lack of water availability already is seriously impacting construction activities south of the Delta all the way down to the very bottom of California, as you well know. So obviously you've got your hand on the pulse here.
It's literally
yeah, the pulse.
We're very aware of that.
Thank you.
We have one public speaker on this, Paul Weakland. You want to add to it?
I just wanted to highlight the Chuck Armour runs a CRAC program, and it's a monitoring program. And I just wanted to highlight that you saw numbers with confidence intervals around them and a very comprehensive monitoring system. And I noted they're spending $15 to $16 million a year monitoring the Delta. Think of that as we think about monitoring our MPAs and MLMA issues. I mean, that gives you some scale to think about in terms of what it costs to do some of this work.
It's not inconsistent with the first numbers that you passed by months ago on what MLPA might cost.
My point is to do scientifically credible analysis and monitoring that gives you the clarity that you're seeing in the Delta is not a cheap operation. I just thought I'd bring that to you.
Mr. Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. Well, as we can remember in recent history, this is like ditto, an exact replay of the herring presentation, the dire problems with the herring. And now what are we finding? Rather than go back and see where your studies were flawed, we're going to push ahead. But Let's just talk about herring in San Francisco Bay.
No, this let's talk about the like subject before you.
The subject before us. The studies are flawed.
Thank you. Okay. Next item. Department update on the... Possible adoption of commission policy regarding cooperatively operated rearing programs for salmon and steelhead. It says Manji down here, but I assume that's...
He left me holding the bag. Real quickly, we had come before you... That's a personal thing. We came before you earlier with a proposed version of an update to an existing policy you have. It included some segments bringing in the aquatic education program that uses anadromous fish for educational purposes. After some internal discussion, we've decided to remove that program because it comes under a separate oversight. We enter into agreements with the educational institutions on the use, and we feel there's really no need to bring that or identify it in this particular policy. So what you have before you is a version we gave you before minus the references to the aquatic ed programs. And again, it's simply a recommendation to you in terms of what you have left now is really updating the language in the policy to reflect current issues relative to steelhead and anadromous.
Right.
Other anadromous.
I guess I need
any
a
questions?
Motion.
Commissioners, your pleasure. So moved?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay.
Did you get that? Jerry, did you get that?
Yeah, she got it.
Cool.
Okay, one public speaker on this item, Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland, is that the proper procedure to vote before public comment? We know that the aquaculture facility, these rearing programs, and the fish hatcheries have not been truthful or honest that the hybrid fish, the genetically altered species that are being introduced into our environment, are a scourge. And you are not addressing these concerns. Even though we have mounds of evidence that these genetically altered species are spoiling the gene pool and the genetic reservoir of our native salmon, trout, steelhead, California golden trout, Paiute, cutthroat trout, on and on and on. And you are the people that are responsible for allowing this to happen. I believe you are shirking your responsibilities and are derelict in your duties about the aquaculture issue. We know that there's a mechanism in nature that creates large die-offs when too much genetic diversity is present, but you don't want to reflect these realities in any of your documents. In fact, you have destroyed documents in studies that concern these problems of fouling the genetic reservoir and the gene pool. We also have identification problems with aquacultured salmon. We have aquaculturists that want you to believe that any salmon missing an adipose fin comes from a hatchery. We know this is not true, and that wild salmon also have this adipose fin missing naturally. Now, these concerns are almost fraud because of the large amounts of grant money that are going in to these stocking programs. And we also realize that the amount of fish that are being stocked every year under the guise of helping the resource is a misnomer, because less than 1 million fish are being introduced into the environment with cataclysmic effects. Yet you don't want to acknowledge all of this because of the money these hatchery guys are getting out of the taxpaying dollars, out of the general fund. Oh, what a mechanism you've got in place here. And so rather than admit that one day of sport fishing takes out all of the fish that were introduced in a year, you know, these hypocrisies are not being properly transmitted to our legislature or our concerned citizens.
Thank you, Mr. Weakland. I certainly would like to know what's going on with all the money, since we have hatcheries that are closing down. So I haven't seen any evidence of tons of money going towards hatcheries. But if somebody can share that with me, I certainly would love to see it. Okay. Next item. Oh, I think we're holding the vote open on that. I know, but it's just so she can. her vote since she's here. Okay, it's still open. Okay.
Item 6, receipt of department report and recommendation on its review of the following commission policies: management and utilization of fish and wildlife on federal lands, management and utilization of fish and wildlife on private lands, multiple use of lands administered by the Department of Fish and Game, naming installations, and national forests. Sankey?
The commission has in its packet basically our review of those policies, and based on that review, the department believes it's adhering to those policies to the best of its abilities and is currently recommending no changes to the standing policies. Do you have any questions?
Anyone?
Two public speakers.
Okay. We have two public speakers.
Two public speakers, Virginia Handley and Paul Weakland.
Hello, Virginia Handley, Animal Switchboard. I have concerns about two of the policies, which I've probably stated in the past, too. As far as the management utilization of fish and wildlife on private land, I have always been concerned, as are many people who hunt, on this issue of late hunts, of hunting animals when they are in rut. And I know it's a big incentive for people to join the private lands management program, but I think there are some real issues with the late hunts. Concerning the multiple use of lands administered by the Department of Fish and Game, this one also bothers me, and that I just don't see how it is should be the policy, the responsibility, that in every single acre of land that Fish and Game Department has any jurisdiction over, that there must be hunting on those lands. I don't see how that is many times not necessarily the most responsible use of that land. And in the policy, you even go as far as saying that you want it's the policy that there should be hunting on the land, even if the land is acquired for the protection of threatened and endangered species. And also later policy that you have on this same subject, that you also include the use of dogs in this hunting policy, so that every opportunity there must be hunting with dogs, even if the land could be acquired for the protection of species. And I know the last hearing that we had, there was talk about the riverside, maybe opening that up to hunting, when that may not be the best use of that land. Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. I'm concerned with the naming of these installations. I went through a marine subcommittee meeting and 2 days of commission meeting when this was discussed early on, more than 10 years ago. And we do not feel it is appropriate to name any of these installations, areas, or anything like that after people, individuals, groups, or foundations. This is because of the motivating factors that are involved. And I hope that you'll do your homework and go back to these previous meetings when this was discussed, because it doesn't seem like we're doing our homework on these issues. They just keep coming back. No naming of installations after people. The motivating factors would skew and eliminate the real, true ideologies and reasons for these places.
That includes you?
That includes me.
All right. Deal. Sankey?
I would like to go on the record. The department completely agrees with Mr. Weakland on this matter.
Holy cow.
And it's consistent with your policy. So
I wonder if you would talk, address a little bit about what Virginia says, because while I think where and when hunting is compatible, I think, and feasible, that when we acquire lands, that's what we look at. When I'm sitting on the Wildlife Conservation Board, those are some of the questions that I ask. First and foremost is their public access, because I really don't think we ought to be buying land unless the public has the ability to recreate on in some form or another. So some of these areas that I know that have endangered species now, it could be a, you know, giant redwood. I don't see that a dog or somebody walking around is going to hurt that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Thank you, commissioners, for the question, actually. Virginia Handley should know that, and before the commission, this has been an issue, both pro-use and no-use. The department, as you know, has ecological reserves and wildlife areas where we encourage hunting, for example, and other uses, and then others where you've heard, much to your own chagrin, where we're encouraging very limited public use. And again, it goes back to the roots of our fundamental multi-purpose function in terms of our natural resources. There are places that we acquire through the WCB that are sometimes very specific. Sometimes we've acquired lands for a specific little critter that's threatened or endangered, the last piece of habitat. And so depending on the nature of that critter, it may or may not be wise, if the intent is to protect it, to allow certain uses. You know, if, for example, if it was a rabbit, allowing dogs to roam free on the place probably wouldn't be a real smart idea, or hunting that rabbit.
Right.
So those are things the department considers when it submits a proposal for acquisition, and you have our assurances, as would be consistent with your policy we just talked about or alluded to. We are always looking for providing public opportunity with no prejudice against particular types of use wherever it's feasible based on the purpose of its acquisition.
Thank you. Okay. Department report on legislation.
The session has been out,
right,
and so there's nothing to report at this time.
Go ahead.
Or I should say the legislature's been out.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, well, I want to make one question to the department and a kind of a comment on the Dana Point issue, which is we had to send a letter. The commission did send a letter to the Joint Committee on Fishing and Aquaculture. There's a policy committee. I don't remember the exact name. Sankey, do you remember the name? But to let them know that we were going to possibly adopt changes to a marine protected area, the Dana Point Lobster. So that has been sent. Julie Oatman helped craft that, and we haven't received a response yet on that, but I just wanted to let the commission know that went forward. And I don't know if the department had any feedback yet on that either.
No, the as John points out, we have complied with the law on that particular request to change. It's on your agenda. We are getting some comments about it, though. It'll be interesting to see how the issue's dealt with, because we're getting some constituents who have some issues that, but it's just preliminary as far at this moment. But we have not heard back from the legislature.
All right. Department's budget?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, Mr. Weakland.
Item 7, Virginia Handley, Paul Weakland.
Virginia Handley, Animal Switchboard. And thank goodness, yes, they went home for a month. So we have not had legislative activity. When we were in Mammoth Lakes, I gave a legislative report. Something that has come up that may be of interest to the commission, and I was going to talk to these gentlemen, too. We have a bill, seems very unrelated, but there's a bill to prohibit the tethering of dogs and for more than 3 hours a day. And this, it's geared towards... it's meant for these dogs who just live at the end of a chain for 24 hours a day. That was the purpose of the bill. It's been a problem for many, many, many years. But I was bothered when I discovered that they've given an exemption to basically hunting dogs. And so I'm trying to find out. I don't think that hunting dogs are housed at the end of tethers. I mean, they don't live on the end of tethers. I don't think so. So I'm trying to find out, is the problem why they got this exemption? And the exemption is so written in a confusing way, you really don't know what it's for. But it's basically if it's any state-licensed activity, then it is exempt from this prohibition. So I'm trying to find out, is the problem because that this limits it to 3 hours, or are these hunting dogs really living in those conditions? I don't think that they are. I mean, so at this point, I'm seeing about trying to get the bill amended just to say you can't house a dog in that manner. Being on a tether for 3 hours is not the worst thing to happen to a dog. Sometimes that may be the only time they get out. But so I'm trying to find out what the situation is with how are hunting dogs housed, why would they need an exemption from this law.
Virginia, help me. First time I've heard of this bill. Does the bill preclude some homeowner who has a perfectly okay tether system, you know, shade, water, you know, the whole thing, and they go away for 4 hours? It's illegal for them to do that?
This says for 3 hours, and they have to be performing a temporary task while the dog is on there for 3 hours.
Who has to be performing a temporary task?
The owner. I think it's irrelevant what the owner's doing, you know, for 3 hours. He could be sitting in there watching TV, and he lets his dog at the end of a tether to sit out in front. Dogs like to have to sit out in front of their place. And
Whose bill is this, by the way?
It's Senator Lowenthal's bill. And it's been an issue for many, many years, and you'll find animal control, they get the most complaints about these poor dogs that just live on a tether for 24 hours.
And they bark or something.
Yeah, they become the big barkers, too.
Right.
It would allow, if they're on a run, kind of like a clothesline thing.
Yeah.
We do have an existing law about tethering dogs or tethering animals. They're supposed to have access to some exercise area, which they really never do, but food, water, shelter. But animal control gets the most complaints because every neighbor knows who these dogs are, who
so
just live that way 24 hours a day.
As an example, if I have a dog that has, I have a kennel that's 6 foot, 6.5 foot high, and the dog continues to jump out of the kennel, if I tethered him, that would be illegal then.
That would be a violation. You just need a higher fence.
It'll make them higher.
What we're hoping is that people would build fences or bring their animal inside.
So we can eat the house. That's a great idea.
And a lot of these people shouldn't have dogs.
Well,
that's the other option.
You know, but
if
there are also
the
dogs that are really better outside, not inside. You know, for anybody who has a dog knows that.
Yeah. Well, we've been very supportive of the bill and the concept of the bill, but this issue has come up about.
But I tell you, Virginia,
dogs,
I can
I
think of
why
so many homeowners who have their dogs in absolutely wonderfully humane conditions, where the dog is perfectly, safe and cool and watered and fed for more than 3 hours on a tether, and to render them illegal, I don't understand that logic, frankly.
Well, the reason for it was the issue of enforceability.
Yeah, it's the law of unintended consequences, though. I mean, you end up with people who are doing the right thing for their animals, and they're going to be rendered illegal to do something. Now, what you're going to end up is probably having fewer animals.
Yeah, and
maybe that's the intention.
You have an animal control officer. Does he have to sit there for those 3 hours to know that the animal didn't get off? It's going to be very hard to enforce no matter what it says. But I was not supportive at all and was disturbed to find that that basically the hunting dogs had been exempted, and I didn't really know why. Thank you.
What few commissioners are here? Paul Weakland. I'm concerned about this Dana Point, the marine protected areas at Dana Point that were created so we could judge, gauge, and evaluate the different strategies and the habitat changes. Now, this area was said to be the pristine focal point of our marine protected areas.
We've moved on. We're not on that subject matter anymore.
We are on that subject, sir.
Was that we sent it out on that? Okay.
And so here we are again that this area has baseline studies.
Well, Paul.
You know that this also has criteria for failure.
Well, if you're going to speak, you're going to speak to the subject, and the subject is we sent a letter.
And the letter is done without doing good homework because
so you're
the new people in the department.
You're opposed to our letter is what you're saying, our position on that.
Yes, I am, because your homework is not done.
Okay.
This area is a prime example of failure of a marine protected area.
You made your point. Thank you. Okay. Update on the department's budget. Unless commissioners had questions on that. Fine. We'll move along.
Good morning still. Good afternoon, commissioners.
Yeah.
What I'd like to do, and if you're interested, is I could recap in categories, kind of the new funding and positions the department got in this year's budget above our base. It's rather significant. I will provide you the details. Do you want me to run through them?
Are there one-time monies or?
No, permanent and one-times. It's quite a mix. I will be providing you kind of a summary for your digestion later. Do you want me to go through it real quickly, or do you want me to just turn in a summary later? It's your pleasure.
I'd like to hear it myself.
Okay.
Just a recap.
Yeah, I didn't want to bore you to death with a lot of detail. Real quickly then, we got authority to spend $1.5 million of the Bay Delta Enhancement Stamp, which is wonderful news because we got a good bank account in there to start doing fisheries-oriented work in the Delta. We got some funding for San Joaquin River restoration, which will also be good for fisheries. We also got some funding for T&E species mitigation on DFG lands, which will go to help better manage some of our lands, mitigation lands. We got some additional funding to help us implement ALDS, and yes, it is actually going to happen. The contract is signed. We're working out the details now.
Who's the vendor?
You know, I don't recall now that. I almost knew you were going to ask that. It's okay. I'll get you an update because we are moving quickly now, and it's significant because we're going to have to change a bunch of regulations to actually make it work, and you're going to have a lot of discretion when we do that, so we'll be needing to bring that to you soon.
As you know, it's a subject near and dear to my
heart.
Oh,
yeah.
Since I've been fishing in both Florida and Minnesota recently, and they both have it.
Yeah.
That's the same vendor, by the way.
I believe
so. The two of them have the same vendor. I don't know if we are contracting.
Well, the vendor, when I was at the Western Association a couple of weeks ago, many of the Western states asked us, because I said we're getting it. What vendor? Because several of them have complaints about their vendors, and I couldn't tell them. So,
this is the other one.
It's the good one, huh?
It's a good one.
It's a good one. Okay.
Well, I'll tell you one from the user's perspective. Both the vendor who provides Minnesota and Florida worked seamlessly. I mean, it was just great.
I believe it is the same institution or outfit that does Minnesota.
Okay, great. Because it allowed me to fly in late at night, way after being able to get one, get out on the stream crack of dawn before anyone would open up so that I could get a license, and it all worked just like that.
Yeah, I mean, this modern era of spontaneity, you got to be responsive to that sudden urge to go fishing if you don't have a license already. Although we will always be encouraging everybody to buy their annual license every year early.
Well, that's fine, but a visitor you know, has no such interest.
We're going to try and convince them to come back, so an annual license will be better. We also got, as you know, in our reorganization, one of the things we've done is we're consolidating our federal aids grants management administratively. We got some funding to do that, which is critical to meeting the obligations under the Sport Fish and the Pittman-Robertson funding. We also got some additional funding and positions to enhance our production at the mitigation fish hatcheries. Those are largely the salmon fish hatcheries. We did get some additional funding for some of our lands management. We got an aerial dispersal delivery system for Osper. It's a device that you can by plane drop this stuff that breaks up the oil if there's an oil spill. We got a bunch of funding to fix our deficit. You've heard us talk about the deficit in the non-dedicated preservation fund, which was constraining our ability to use some of our dedicated funds. That's been wiped clean. So it will allow us to use monies that have been tied up, which is wonderful news. We've gotten money for the Marine Life Protection Act. I mentioned the summary, a total of $19 million. We in 56 positions. The key pieces of that was, and I'll lump it a little bit, is the Marine Life Protection Act process. We got 11 positions and just over $3 million to continue to the next area. And as you heard yesterday, Mr. Ugritz suggested to heading south. But basically, the new budget gives us positions and funding to do that ourselves. We'll still rely somewhat on our partnership, but we'll be taking a more central role in that with this funding.
Meaning BRT?
Yes.
Doing what that which BRTF was
yeah,
doing?
Yeah, we will take a more central role in conducting the meetings and the stakeholder process this time.
Does that mean the BRTF will no longer exist?
I don't think so. That's something that we're going through. I think there's still a role to some degree, but we have not resolved that yet.
Well, the role of the BRTF is so that someone other than the Fish and Game Commission is doing the vetting and the heavy lifting.
Yeah, we have not had the staff. They've had to contract out a lot of the work that the department feels it should actually be doing, and apparently the legislature and the governor agreed and has funded us and positions to help run that process.
That'll be really interesting to get your thinking. I'm sure the other commissioners will be interested in that as soon as possible, as to how, if we're not going to do BRTF OID type of interaction so that the commissioners are not having to be involved on a daily basis, if you will. I'd be very interested to see
which commissioners are you referring to?
Us.
Well, yeah, this would... This is not going to cut you out at
all.
Well,
that's what I'm saying. No. I'm not saying I do. It's not I'm worried about getting cut out.
Well, I'm sorry.
I'm worried about getting cut in. You know, the BRTF performed a marvelous function for us.
Absolutely.
They did the heavy lifting in terms of activities and, you know, organizing and all that kind of stuff. That was just great because, we're dancing as fast as we can right here. A few more notes and we're down on our knees, too.
Right.
So what I'd love to understand what your thinking is here as soon as you come
yeah.
You got to what, April of 07 when we start this?
We're actually starting January 07.
January 07.
Yeah. We will be, as soon as I was talking to Mr. Gary Stacey, he couldn't be here, but we'll, at the next meeting, if nothing else, start providing you a lot more detail about what we're actually going to do with this funding since we're pretty much have it figured out. And we'll explain what our role and our responsibilities will be with that funding and the staffing. Another chunk of that money, the marine money, was for helping us implement MLMA, our fisheries management plans. As you know, we have a few. We've not had adequate funding to do that and or start others. So this is, you'll hear again from Gary at probably the next meeting on what our plan is for the MLMA. And a lot of that is also monitoring stock assessments. You know, this is going to give us an opportunity to start clawing ourselves out of this data poor environment. So we're really looking forward to it. And we have a bunch of positions that will help us actually do the work. So very promising. We also got $5 million in 35 positions of that total 56 under an item the legislature put in called the bottom trawling regulation, implementing of the trawl bill, as you heard that debate before you about our inability to implement the trawl bill. What we did was get $5 million in 35 positions to implement the trawl bill, MLMA, MLPA, and the fisheries aquaculture EIR. As you know, the aquaculture industry needs to do a programmatic EIR. We haven't had the funding. We're going to be able to use some of this funding to do that, although it sounds like the OPC has funded it, so we'll free up some other money. We'll, again, provide some more details. We also got funding for early detection of highly pathogenic avian influenza. As you know, the department's role in the old avian influenza is largely a monitoring detection out in the field. We got positions and funding to do that part of our job with the other federal and state entities. By the way, if you want an update on the latest strategy on dealing with avian influenza, we can come back to you at another meeting, because the planning stages are largely over now, so we can show who does what and how are we going to respond and what we're doing. So if you're interested, I'll work with Mr. Carlson to put that on an agenda. We also got some funding and positions for Bolsa Chica lands. Members in the legislature have been trying to enhance our function and management there. They support it, and the governor approved providing additional support there. As you know, CalFIT, it was one permanent position, two temp helps, and $216,000, largely as a match with a partnership with the local folks there that have been contributing quite a bit to the management. And so we'll have a better ability to partner in managing the Bolsa Chica lands. CalFed's in flux. It's the department is taking over a lot of that. We got some funding and positions to transition that to the department. That's still under fine-tuning, if you will. Again, something you're already well aware of was the Cogdill's AB7 bill, which provided a bunch of positions and funding and created the new HIF fund, which will be able to fully fund our hatcheries and with a goal of ramping up production and also enhancing our wild and heritage trout programs. We can also, perhaps at the next meeting, if you're interested, give you the details on what we are planning for the hatcheries and wild trout program. We've almost got that all figured out now. We also got some funding for emergency work on our ecological reserves. We suffered a lot of damage during the floods this last winter. They gave us already $8.8 million. A lot of it's levee repair work. And let's see. We also got some refunded some of the salmon steelhead trout restoration grant program. And we got a sizable amount of money, $10 million for non-game fish and wildlife programs, which will be focused on our non-game critters. And let's see. And that's kind of the highlights. I know it's a lot of detail.
What did we get for game?
Pardon?
For non-game, it's 10.
Oh. 10 million. The bottom line of all that funding was the department has 139.1 new permanent positions, 29 new temporary help positions, and a total increase in our budget of $92.3 million, which is a very large increase. $62 million of that was general fund. So it's a huge increase.
All this newly acquired wealth that you have, how many positions is the commission going to secure out of this?
You guys blanked, but we're working on something there. As you know, the process...
Yeah.
Well, I didn't say it was the right answer. It is the answer, though.
Okay.
There's a rude buzzer sound that should have been when that answer came across.
Just trying to be, as you know, Mr. Weakland has challenged me to be truthful, so I'm just telling you the truth.
Right.
We didn't score any administrative positions at all. We also had our request for enhancing our administrative function did not succeed through the budget process. As you know, we've already begun the new budget process for the 07-08 year. We've already gotten feedback from the resource agency. Part of the feedback has been supportive of some enhancements. I can't give you a lot of the details because of the nature of that business, but we are working with your staff, Mr. Carlson, on trying to enhance our capabilities of managing this public responsibility I call rulemaking, which has grown tremendously, as we all know, over the last several years.
At the risk of sounding like I'm threatening, the commission staff and the commissioners have been asked to do something for a long period of time for which they were seriously unfunded. The commission is now in a position to return the favor with MLPA.
Yeah.
I would suggest that the department be extremely interested in providing the teeny tiny amount of additional funding that were required.
We are extremely aware of that, and your executive director has made me extremely aware of that interest. So we are working with agency and administration to see what we can get worked out. And as you know, the budget process is confidential at this point, so I would talk more about you, but I can't.
That's pretty much along the lines of what I was going to say. It was a joint effort of a lot of different constituency groups and as well as this commission that helped accomplish the department getting a budget like they got. And without that, I don't think that it would be there. And in order to continue the plus budget in the future years, you're probably going to need this commission's help again. And the more staff we have, the easier it is going to be for us to help.
Right. Yep.
I couldn't wish more than to have more help for us all, and that is something we all are looking for. And Commissioner Kellogg is absolutely right. We would not be here if it wasn't for all the folks that showed up during the legislative hearings, the constituents letting the representatives know that this isn't working, we need to enhance it. I did leave out a very important piece. The administration and the legislature did put aside some increased funding for warden salary. As you know, one of our biggest problems, and you will hear some of this on the 15th, while we did in fact get positions for enforcement for MLPAs, I'll tell you quite bluntly, I can't fill them. You know, until they fix the salary issue, those positions are largely unfillable. So, but
what was the total number of positions for enforcement? Not just MLPA, but the total.
Total is currently about 340, I believe. I don't know if Tony. 340. That's total. That's all positions. Mm-hmm. We have just under 200, 190 some odd wardens in the field at
right.
any one time. So those are our current numbers, and our vacancies about 50 or 60.
And their salary's been froze for several years.
Right,
while
the
CHP just got $1,000 a year increase for each.
Sure did.
Yeah, the current budget only increased warden positions by 9, was it?
Although union just didn't send
so there's so. Money there for increased salaries, which
the,
is where what we need to fix.
Yes,
first.
the budget requests the DPA to work with the union and the department to try and enhance salaries, which, if they are successful, will allow us to offer a wage, would make us competitive, and to actually fill these vacant positions. Without that, it ain't going to happen. I mean, I can guarantee you that. It's just, we can't recruit them.
Well, let us know if there's any help we can be in that process as you continue.
And you're going to be lucky to keep what you got.
Well, we're not.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the bottom line.
Right,
we're
going to lose.
We're having an increasing number. Tony can share the details, but we are actually training officers for other agencies now. They're high grading us. You know, they let us train them, and we have an excellent training program.
20% finder's fee, at least. I mean, come on.
Tony might look into that.
I shared that at the last commission meeting, but I had an opportunity to meet with a building department enforcement officer who used to be a game warden and loved being a game warden, but he making twice the money doing that.
Right.
And he couldn't support his family and not take that position.
Well, I think the the parity issue of highway patrol is in fear of the fact that they'd probably lose half their force if they had game wardens had parity, because a lot of them would come back or come over. That's
right.
A lot of them originally wanted to go into DFG, but opted for highway patrol because of the pay. So,
well, my profound thanks for people in the audience who have done quite a bit of work on this
yes.
subject. Thank you very much for those of
absolutely.
You who are involved. Eric, for one.
All right. Any other questions, commissioners, on that item? I think we're going to adjourn to executive session and lunch at the same time. We kill two birds with one stone.
We're eating birds?
Yeah.
Stones. Mm.
Bird stones.
Bird
quarter
stones.
Of one will be recommence at 1:15.
Yeah. We'll harvest two birds with one stone.
Two birds. There you go.
Okay. Steve, you're up. We're ready to go. All right, welcome back. We're now out of executive session. Mr. Cunningham.
Thank you, Mr. President. Bill Cunningham, Deputy Attorney General and Counsel for the Fish and Game Commission. The commission has just met in executive session to discuss matters in litigation pursuant to Government Code Section 11-125. We have no action to report out of that executive session meeting. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Item B.
Eight B. Yeah. Good afternoon, commissioners. We are reviewing Dr. Staub's neg deck, and we're also working with him on establishing this kind of advisory committee working group on what we do with reptiles. I chatted with him actually this morning. He was fine. He actually left saying, right, that sounds good.
So okay. Very good.
Thank ongoing.
You. Thank you for working with him, and look further to further updates. Okay. Update on Salton Sea. Item number C. Or do we have public testimony on that?
No.
Okay.
Mr. Staub is not here.
Salton Sea?
That yeah, that's well? Me. The PEIR continues, and we're receiving and reviewing the versions of the EIR for the Salton Sea. Once the review is complete, the resource agency, it'll go to the resource agency for approval and then release to the public. That's a programmatic EIR for the Salton Sea. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have used the acronym. The public release of the document will probably not occur before the advisory committee meeting in, on August 2nd, which has occurred, so I'm not sure the latest. And the public outreach meetings are scheduled for August 22nd through the 24th. So that's the update on the Salton Sea. Okay. Any questions?
No. Commissioners? None? No public testimony? Update on coho salmon?
On the this is regarding the coho salmon incidental take regulations for forestry. Just as a real quick recap, in February 2004, the commission accepted the coho salmon recovery strategy. The commission directed the department develop regulations and authority of Fish and Game Code Section 2112 to guide the incidental take decisions and permitting process for forestry operations on private land. After the February meeting, the DFG met with numerous stakeholders and developed draft regulations that are near final, in a near final form. The DFG deferred proceeding with the regulatory process pending the outcome of a legal challenge to the coho listing, as you're aware of, which has now been decided in favor of the department. The draft working plan for fishing DFG to implement the draft regulations establishes a January 29th, 2008 effective date for the regulations, and we're moving forward and on track for this schedule. The draft regulations will establish options for state incidental take permitting, including a prescriptive alternative which builds upon existing threatened and impaired watershed forestry practice rules, and an abbreviated DFG approval process, something I know Commissioner Rogers would appreciate, trying to streamline the application and processing of incidental permits. Secretary Chrisman has outlined an alternative strategy which integrates prescriptive components of the draft 2112 regulations into the forestry practice rules. DFG will then implement its regulations to describe the procedural requirements which rely on the forest practice rules. This would integrate CDF into the incidental take permitting process, which would hopefully reduce regulatory duplication, a big issue, and shortens the time period for DFG to complete its rulemaking. So this is a really a partnership in terms of this rulemaking that's critical. The prescriptive requirements for the 2112 regulations do require additional protections for aquatic habitat within the THPs. This include wider buffer zones for some streams, additional protection for geologically unstable areas, and specific road construction, maintenance, and operation measures. This has generated some of the recent controversy and negotiations. Based upon extensive analysis, DFG does believe these measures will not require significant economic or operational commitments by landowners and are feasible to implement. And we hope to have this done soon. Any questions?
Yes, if I may. How closely do these what you're proposing mirror or or equal to the forest practice rules, because they address the same exact issue.
Yeah, and they are different in different ways. As you know, there's many different sections of those rules.
Intimately, I know.
Yeah, I am preaching to the choir here. Some of those rules have not been very good from our point of view in terms of exactly. sequential issues. And we're simplifying them so the sequential issues become moot. That's causing some problems. And I can go into a lot more detail with a side-by-side document we have. We're working with CDF. We have some significant issues we're still trying to hammer out. And, of course, it's mostly with retention along streams. That yeah. is really one of the
fundamental. You mean for canopy closure, yes, canopy. Stream temperature,
yeah.
et cetera?
We're
and turbidity, for that matter.
We're tending towards simplifying by retaining, for example, it might be retaining the 10 largest trees per section, mm-hmm. whereas they're looking for just a canopy. And so that affects what you harvest and don't harvest, and there's some issues we're trying to resolve there.
Okay, help me here. Would the THP process still be run by CDF? To what extent would we be involved in that?
That's the part I'm not as clear.
Because there's
yet.
Your redundancy in time. I mean, the department, don't we really want to be, isn't well, the object of this is to have a cooperative agreement where they end up fundamentally performing our
yeah,
function
remember, yeah,
with
we
their THP process.
Right. We will be issuing the incidental take permit, and we're trying to streamline the rules so when they go through a THP.
It's done.
Yes. Okay. That's the simplest way to say it. That their THP.
But you don't want to give up. You want to be extremely careful about not giving up on any of the things that we know to be necessary for the salmon, well, for the anadromous fish.
Right. Our job as Fish and Game is to make sure that we are the incidental take issues. CDF's job is a timber harvest, and we want to mesh those so that when they go through and do a timber harvest plan, we can, as a result of their practices and agreements and rules, be able to issue an incidental take permit for that timber harvest. So it's an alignment.
Help me, if this thing were, I'm sorry, is this okay? Do you envision us not being able to be in agreement with CDF on any one of these things?
No, I think all the issues are completely resolvable.
Okay.
I don't see any.
Because I wouldn't see that it, from our perspective, I wouldn't want us to give in on anything that Fish and Game felt was important for the viability of those streams from an anadromous fish population.
Yeah, we
and I presume we're not doing that.
No, we are adhering to our what we believe our roles for stewardship protection of the natural resources, and we are an incredibly reasonable outfit. And so I'm thinking the combination of us having clear goals in protecting these fish and being willing to work on something that's manageable from a THP point of view, I think it's doable. As you know, sometimes it's a few sticking points. That
I do know that. One of the problems that CDF has got is that there's an immense, from the landowners and, you know, and the various timber interests and whatnot, there's immense political interaction between the whole Milan. I mean, having been chairman of forest practice for 6 years, I understand this really well. And I think that we're in a better position, actually, than they are to protect those fish. If we do this right. I also think the regional water quality boards are in a better position as well, but that's neither here nor there.
The good news is Mark Stouffer, I think you've heard from Mark before.
Right.
He's our point person on this and has been keeping us updated, and I think is presenting CDF some very practical, simplified measures that allow us to issue an incidental take permit and protect, allow them to harvest and protect our anadromous fish populations. So I think it's doable. It's just, you know, closing the deal, if you will.
Thank you. You know, because over my tenure in that job, I saw some horrific things that timber harvesters had done to streams. It was just a tragedy.
I think the good news is folks are realizing that's not acceptable, and we're working. And
they plus, were at the time, but
as you know,
still.
The technologies in timber harvest are changing, so they can do things now that
they
couldn't
do.
Think of doing.
Right.
You know, even
also the bad
ago.
Operators have pretty much been made aware of their evil ways, but there were some bad operators.
No, thank you. Do you have anything under other? Very good.
We have one person who wants to speak on that, but I don't know if there's no report.
There's no report. Item 9A, staff reports. WAFA?
Yes. As many of the commissioners may know, 2 weeks ago I went to Bismarck, North Dakota for the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies annual conference. It was only 99 there, not 115 like here in Sacramento, so it was a nice escape. This is the first WAFA that I have attended. Unfortunately, no one else from the commission was able to attend, but several folks from the department attended, Ryan Broderick, Banky Curtis, and Chief Nancy Foley. And the Western Association, for any commissioners who don't know, it's a combination of state departments and state commissions and Canadian provinces in the West. So there's a total of 23 states and provinces that are members of the Western Association, and 20 out of the 23 were in attendance for this conference. There was a separate breakout meeting with commissioners, all of the states' commissions, and then a combo with the directors and commissions, then a combo of the whole shooting match. I learned a lot from the other commissioners and other states' commissions. They learned a lot from us. They were impressed with how large our budget was compared to theirs, but most of the states, some of them have a departments. Most of the other departments, their commission don't have a staff.
They don't have staff.
They use the department as their staff.
Yep.
So it was, we're in a quite a leadership role, I'd say, from that perspective.
In those situations, John, does the commission appoint the director
some.
Of the department?
Some.
Sometimes
that's
they make a
that's how that would work.
Sometimes they make a, like Nevada right now, they have a vacancy at their directorship. The commission is gonna shorten the list to 3 and then forward it to the governor of Nevada. Governor then will make the pick, and then it will have to be confirmed by their legislature.
Mm-hmm.
So and then as far as, you know, there's differences in reporting structure. Some directors report directly to the commission on a hiring, firing thing, but a lot of them, it's still a governor.
Okay.
It was a great meeting, a lot of discussion on current events, and I gave them we gave them an update on what's going on in California. We received updates for the other states. Some of the biggest issues for them in the West are issues with wolves. And issues with overpopulation of elk on some national parks in the West, and it's really getting to be a critical situation. Chronic wasting disease also, there's a lot of concern that people are getting complacent with chronic wasting disease, that the hunters are getting complacent, that the research dollars are going to possibly be drying up because they've kind of hit a wall on research and finding out what causes it and how it's spread. So there was concern about that the federal dollars, there was a prediction that within the next couple of years they might dry up. And I know the state of California gets some of those dollars also. Our own enforcement did some enforcement actions along the border last hunting season for out-of-state hunters bringing deer and elk in from the West. And right now this commission passed, the newer commissioners passed a regulation about 3-4 years ago to ban the importation of hunter harvested elk and deer, certain parts, the brain materials, spinal materials. Tony, you might be able to help me out here. When enforcement did those stops along the border, it was a terrible compliance with the law. And, you know, just another sign that this is kind of people are getting complacent about it. And so that was a concern amongst the western states. Right.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if it was complacency or if the we were thinking maybe people didn't understand that they weren't supposed to be bringing it. So we've worked on a flyer that we're going to, I believe it's been approved to be given out at all the western states so that we get the word out. Because the number of animals we were seeing coming across, were it was, I don't know, 70% violation rate or something. It was huge. Yeah. So.
The, go ahead.
Part of the issue in terms of education is that not all the areas that hunters hunt are incorporated in what we call the CWD zone. So they're assuming that, hey, if it's not within that zone, then I'm free to bring it in. So it's just, that's, we just have to do a better job of educating them and informing them.
Two other things I wanted to mention out of that meeting. In September, the National Association, which is used to be called the International Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, they've changed their name now to the just Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, and that's the 50 states and all the provinces in Canada. They're going to have their annual national meeting in Aspen, Colorado, starting on September 17th. There's been a move by the Western Association commissioners to, you know, there's a commissioner committee at the Western Association, but there's no such committee at the national. And they're trying to resurrect that. There's apparently a lot of resistance in the East. The commissions and the directors don't get along as well as we do in the West, and that's the word I hear. Anyway, so there is a call out, and I think there'll be more materials that I'll be able to get to the commissioners here to try to encourage some commissioners to go to this association meeting in September in Aspen. Yes, I figured. Yeah. A commissioner from Colorado is encouraging this, and she said if she can't attract people to Aspen in September, then there's something wrong. So I'm waiting to hear a little more information from her. She's trying to see if there's going to be enough interest by commissioners nationwide to really push this. So hopefully, there was concern they might have been starting this move a little too late for this September, and maybe next year, I believe the meeting's in Kentucky. Sankey, do you know where next year's AFWA meeting is off the top of your head?
It's Arizona, I think. Then it's...
No, that's the Western.
Oh, the Western. No, I'm not sure.
I think it's Kentucky.
Is it Kentucky?
Anyway, it's not in the West next year, the national meeting. So I'll have more info for that. The other thing I wanted to mention was our former executive director, Bob Trainer, was in attendance. And at the banquet, the awards banquet, he received an honorary lifetime membership award for in honor of his years of service. He had been attending, I think it was the last 17 years worth of Western Association meetings and done a lot of committee work and had done a lot of special projects for them.
He's a star there. I went to one of them with him, and everybody there knew.
And as far as future meetings, the annual midwinter meeting, which traditionally is held in San Diego, this January is going to be held in Tucson. And then next summer's meeting is in Flagstaff for the Western Association. So just want to get that out there. I believe the dates for the January meeting in Tucson coincide with quail season. That's my report on the Western Association.
My last two.
So that's item 3A, public comment on that.
Item 9B, update on live animal market, special hearing.
Yeah, I'll pass that to one of my award-winning staff members, Adriana Shea.
Commissioners, there has been a request from Mr. Mills, who is the original requester, that the commission authorized staff to publish notice of its intent to amend the regulations to prohibit the importation of some of the animals sold in the live markets, and that be done before the special hearings are held in the Bay Area, since it is required to hold public hearings and get public testimony on a regulatory change. So he requested that we add that to our late August agenda.
And we do have two public speakers on this.
And staff would agree with that. It does make sense. Then we wouldn't have to do two sets of hearings.
Yeah.
And we could hold the hearings at special evening times and locations in the Bay Area.
Yeah, I just have a question just for clarification, and I'm not talking about that. When we originally, I think President Flores or myself, I forget who, yelled it out, let's have a special hearing on this with the intent of looking at whether or not to ban importation. I was wondering, why can't we just notice the item and then there's a number of hearings that naturally take place in order to consider that action? I mean, I don't know why we have to, I forgot why we have to have special hearings in the Bay Area. I'm just wondering, I want to have hearings and have people come in and talk about it, but why can't we just make it a regular agenda item and say, what is it, a two-month process before we can actually act?
Well, I thought the idea was to go for an informational to find out and listen to get some public input as to the issue, and not necessarily.
Yeah, I'm just wondering why we're going there. where the belly of the beast.
Well, because I think that's where we need.
Okay, I forgot we were actually doing it. Yeah.
All right, let's get there.
Public speakers on this would be Eric Mills, Virginia Handley.
Commissioners, again, Eric Mills with Action for Animals. Might point out, I was in the live animal markets in San Francisco for about 3 hours Saturday a week ago. There's a reporter on assignment for the National Geographic, and she's doing a big story on the animal diseases and the possible transfer to humans. So she spent some time there, and then again with Dr. Harkowitz, who's the veterinarian in Berkeley, who's been doing the necropsies for us. Those reports are in now. He did 9 necropsies for us, and all the animals are pretty heavily parasitized. Miles Young, former game warden, just got back from L.A. last weekend, where he spent a couple days in the markets there, also in Stockton, San Francisco, Oakland, and Sacramento. And he's working on his report, which should be ready in the next couple of days. My idea... It wasn't my idea. I mean, Mr. Flores, I think, wanted to go to notice early on, and I asked that he hold off until we could get some of these reports from Dr. Harkowitz and the investigation that Miles Young was doing. But that's done now, and I think in the interest of time, I mean, just going to notice when you have to have a public hearing anyway, but if you want to get extra information, that's fine, too. As Mr. Hattori pointed out, I think it would be wise to hold it somewhere other than Chinatown, San Francisco. It was done about 10 years ago, and it was... quite raucous. Then we had 40 cops in full riot gear. One of our people got knocked to the ground. It was very unpleasant. And most of the people there didn't speak English, and it was translated and mistranslated, I'm sure, because some ugly things were said. So whatever you see fit to do, I hope it'll happen soon. I might point out, too, that one of the turtles that we got at the markets for the necropsies was a non-permitted species, a river cooter, just by chance. So. Illegal or not permitted.
I'm sorry, say that again, Eric.
A turtle called a river cooter.
It was separate, what?
Was purchased for necropsy in the markets. Quite often, unpermitted species will come through, like Florida soft shells or smooth soft shells. We've seen map turtles, and there are only two species which are permitted, the red-eared slider and the spiny soft shell, neither of which is native to California. And they're still being bought and dumped. So that's a concern. As I said at the last hearing, I think that I've had a call from a Buddhist who does animal liberation ceremonies, and they routinely every year go out and buy lots of these animals from the markets and release them to the wild. Everything from frogs and turtles to a lot of birds this past spring, which up here in the North County somewhere. Oh, when I was in the markets, too, with this reporter on Saturday, that was one of the hot days in San Francisco, which they rarely have, and a bird market, they must have had cages yay tall with chukar partridge and Japanese quail, and they were so crowded in there, really overheated. The birds were panting with their mouths open. If there had been water on the other side of the cage, they could not have gotten to it. So I called animal control to report it, and the guy who answered the phone says, "We don't deal with live animal market issues." I said, "Excuse me, but you do. It's the state law, and Carl Friedman, your boss, and I have talked about this a lot, so let me have the dispatcher." So he did, and he sent somebody down and say, at least get the birds some more breathing room. So conditions like this encourage disease and the spread. So that's a concern, too. But again, what we're asking to be put on notice is just the frog and turtle importation and sale. Okay. That's a major concern, which affects wildlife and environment, public health, and unabiding cruelty, which continues to this day. So, thank you.
Virginia Hanley, Animal Switchboard. And I'd certainly be very much in support of going to notice. There's no reason not, that would be before you for any subsequent hearing, which you have to have anyway. So you're going to be doubling up on hearings if you wait for a special hearing. And I've attended, there was more than one in San Francisco, and I just don't know what information you can get from those hearings. Very little information came out of them. It was really just people protesting that they were opposed to it. I mean, I remember a commission hearing in Sacramento on it, and you know, busloads came up and they were passing around turtle parts. I've never seen anything pass so gingerly among the commissioners to get it to the next guy. You know, turtle, maybe snakes. So two go to notice, and I have no feeling at all in support that you need to have a special hearing in San Francisco. After all, the markets are around the state. They're in the Los Angeles, they're in Sacramento. You know, so it's not as though everything has to happen in San Francisco. Now, I had gotten, I had requested from the department, they're very nice to supply me, it was a computer printout of all of these permits. They included all the fish permits. It really is fascinating to see all this list of the permits. But what I was looking for was specifically the turtle and frog permits, and not just a little computer printout, but in the past, I've gotten a copy of the, was really the application, and then the application had been okayed. And on that, you could get more information of what the permit was for, instead of this little thing out of a computer. So I've written back to the department asking for copies of those specific frog and turtle permits. Of course, they want 15 cents a page. So when I get these, I would be happy to give them to you. I think you would get more information from your own department and your own records than you would get from, say, a specific hearing in San Francisco. So I hope I'll be happy to share these with you. I may charge you 15 cents a page. I don't know. But you can certainly get them, too, and I encourage you to do that. I, too, was in the markets last Saturday. I just don't see any improvements from what we've been going through for years. A few of them had, a couple of them had the sign up saying that the animals were to be killed in the market, although we know now if the turtles are not aquaculture, there's no regulation saying they can't be sold alive. Okay. Once again, I'm turning turtles right side up. And all that, and so I mean, if I can get in there and manhandle them, anybody can. Speaking of fish and the markets, anyone who cares for fish, it's heartbreaking. And I've never seen so many dead fish in these tanks, and the crowded conditions. If there's any sort of anything negative that can come out of that. It certainly will.
Thank you, Virginia.
Thank you.
Sankey?
Yeah. The department is interested to know what you'd be going to notice for.
Yeah.
I don't regulate food markets, so I'm just trying to make sure.
I thought it was an amendment to a restricted species list, potentially.
Right. That's what I'm right, because the title is not indicative of our authority. So I just, all I ask is when you go to notice, it's clear specifically what rule you're going to try.
Are we ever unclear? Come on, Sankey.
You're always clear. I'm part of my job is to encourage you to be crystal clear.
I think you know our intent.
Clear.
Maybe you can help coach us on how to be clear on what we want to ask you to do. That would be important.
Yeah, we'll work on
but I think we do want to. I already said it, but yeah, he can encourage us to make sure we tell him clearly what we want, because he knows our intent. But we don't want to obviously try to accomplish the wrong thing. We want to accomplish the right thing.
Okay. Anyone else?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. And we have that.
Okay.
Oh, we have an old notice.
I think we do. We need a motion to.
I'd like to make a motion to go to notice.
I'll second.
We actually
have to add that to our August agenda.
Okay.
Oh. So just the request.
Okay, request to go to notice in our August agenda on the language that will be determined forthwith regarding the live animal markets and the banning of, you know,
and I'll second
forbidden
that.
Species and whatever I'm trying to say, but we will work that language out of the next.
Okay.
We have an old all motion. Right. I just don't know what it
all
says
in
front of me. Yeah.
Aye.
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 Okay.
Thank you. All right. Item number 10, subcommittee.
Actually, I'm sorry. There's a 9C other.
Do you have another item?
He always has an other nowadays.
I have another item. Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
I checked it with the attorney. I forgot to check it with the chair. I just wanted to bring attention to the commission and get some advice from our staff counsel. It's come to my attention we may have a quorum problem on the 25th at the end of this month. And there are two. Well, earlier we said we were going to move waterfowl to Thursday, which is an adoption, so we're going to have to renotice that. But then there's two other items scheduled for the 25th that have already been noticed to be adopted that day. And if we do not have a quorum.
You have to move them all.
Well, we can't move those. My understanding is the reason we can move the waterfowl one up one day is because it's a conformance issue. The others, I believe we would have to move those back, and that's where I want to check with Bill. The other possibility is a phone call in, and one commissioner maybe will call in.
Okay, explain to me why we can't renotice those to the 24th.
There's not enough time.
Sherry, did you?
Not adequate time.
It would be, and let me check with staff here, commercial lobster and herring. For either of those. Oh, so if it's just subject to open meeting, it would be a 10-day notice. Now, one other issue on the lobster is that we told the legislature, asking for their feedback, and we're going to be checking in on that, but that it would be the end of the month, potentially, 25th. So I don't
think one
deal.
Day.
One day.
It's not going to.
So, Mr. Cunningham, are you understanding what I'm asking here? So potentially, here's another possibility. I don't know how long of a day we want on Thursday. We could probably get the whole meeting over on Thursday, because we're talking about if we did that, we would only have one action item on Friday, the 25th, and that would be receipt of public testimony on proposed changes for SQUID.
Well, John, depending on what we have, we might have to flip-flop some of the items. Yeah. That's the other alternative, because it's a travel day. We might just have to swap some of the items.
Yeah, things need action going to the 24th and the other.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Cunningham, do you have any issues with this of moving with a 10-day notice?
As again, Mr. Carlson, members of the commission, if the question is can we move these to the 24th, as long as we provide the minimum 10-day notice that the Open Meetings Act requires, I think we're going to be acceptable for hearing all of these matters on the 24th.
Great. We don't need any motion or anything for that, correct?
Mr. Cunningham, we don't need a motion on that, right?
That's
to move the items from the 25th to the 24th. I think, again, you didn't have a motion. Yeah, I agree with Mr. Kellogg. You haven't had a motion to put them there.
Thank you.
This is just a matter of scheduling between.
Okay. Okay, and I will work with the president on the agenda. Yep.
Okay.
Thank you. That's all I had on other. There is one speaker card on other. Paul Weakland.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Paul.
Item number 10, subcommittee reports and recommendations. Number one, Marine Resources Committee.
We did not hold a Marine Resources Committee.
Okay. Nor did we have an Altauscher, so we have no update on that. Moving along to legislation sub.
We did not have a meeting either.
We did not.
What's that?
Legislation.
We did have a speaker.
Yeah, Paul, did you want to pass on those? There were none of those meetings.
There's no report. There's nothing to speak on.
Which one would that be?
It just says item 10, 1, 2,
if there's no
1
report,
and 3. I'm sorry, 1 and 3.
There's no report.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. This goes to show some of the confusion that consists on this Marine Resources Committee. Now, it used to be the Marine Subcommittee, but we understand that we changed the wording from Subcommittee to Resources Committee so that we could now have subcommittees that will be assigned off of the Resource Committee. This is part of the political double shuffle that we tried to eliminate when we recalled Gray Davis, but it seems to continually snowball, and you are doing it again, even though the people of the state of California is trying to get these commissions and committees reduced. Thank you.
Thank you.
Actually, Paul, for your information, it's always been the Marine Resources Committee.
Yeah, it's in code, actually.
Okay, very good. Legislation subcommittee did not meet. And number 11, receipt of federal agencies informational items.
Yes, we have in the audience Russell Strock, who is the Assistant Regional Administrator for Protected Resources Division of NOAA Fisheries. He'd like to share a few things, I believe, on Klamath. So,
you got more fish?
Thank you. I wish.
Tell us you have more fish.
I wish we did. I wish you had a good story. I'm here on behalf of Rod McGinnis. He asked me to review these comments, more of an update for you folks, just since so much has happened in June and July that he thought the commissioners would benefit from a brief overview. So let me start into that. I think everybody knows the Secretary of Commerce, Carlos Gutierrez, received a request from the governors of Oregon and California and several members of Congress to declare a fishery failure, an economic disaster under the Magnuson-Stevens Act for the commercial salmon fishery in 2006. The ocean salmon fishery has been severely restricted due to the extremely low abundances of Klamath River Falls Chinook. And that's as a result of the exceptionally high mortality rates in the early life stages due to the extended droughts and diseases they experienced 3 to 4 years ago. The Pacific Fishery Management Council projected that the commercial salmon fishery between Cape Falcon, Oregon, and Point Sur, California, would land less than 40% of the average catch during the last 5 years. Early reports this year indicate that that catch is actually somewhere around 10% of that five-year average. It's much lower than we thought. Kind of in response, Bill Hogarth, the head of the director of NOAA, came out in mid-July, just a few weeks ago. He met with representatives from the Oregon and California governor's offices, as well as state fishery agencies, to discuss the situation. He then traveled from he started out in Newport and visited some of the ports down in Charleston, Oregon, Eureka, and down to San Francisco. Met with the fishermen and related support industries, and he was gathering economic information to report back to the Secretary of Commerce on the sort of a firsthand assessment of the situation. He presented that information personally to the Secretary of Commerce a week or two ago. While he was out, the Vice Admiral of NOAA came out to California and met with state representatives as well as the Small Business Administration and the Economic Development Administration on July 21st to share information on the economic relief programs that are being provided to fishing communities. In June, the Secretary of Commerce declared a commercial fishing failure under the Interjurisdictional Fisheries Act, and we expect that a decision regarding the declaration under the Magnuson Act will be made sometime this month. While these declarations are important, any funding for the relief of a declared disaster must be actually appropriated by Congress. NOAA, NIMS, Commerce Department don't actually have money in their budgets to deal with a disaster, unlike FEMA and other disaster-related agencies that get some appropriations. Small Business Administration loans are currently available to fishing communities. The loans may not be that helpful to fishermen, but they will. They can provide some support to the support industries. The fishermen have consistently asked for grants rather than loans because they expect that the economic situation won't be much better until at least 2008 at the earliest. In a related matter, the Southwest Fisheries Science Center, NOAA Science Center down in La Jolla and Santa Cruz, have been developing a demonstration project to test the feasibility of genetic stock identification as a way to craft fishing seasons in the future that will protect the weak stocks and allow harvest of more healthy stocks. The tool holds some promise, but probably won't be ready or usable this coming management season. Just a couple more updates. I've got two more. Another one is that Southwest Region of NIMS, the Department of Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife Service, are scheduling a disease workshop for this fall to deal with some of the concerns about disease in the Klamath, try to find a path forward for that issue. And lastly, at the request of the governor of Oregon and other elected officials, there is a summit being planned between the Secretaries of Commerce, Interior, and Agriculture, as well as the two governors' office to put more attention on the climate issues. So that's basically the update. Not sure if there's any nuggets in there you weren't aware of, but that is what we know to date. And wanted to make sure you had the latest.
Thank you very much. Mr. Weakland?
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. First, we'd like to point out that the federal government has not been honest with the state of California. In our recent investigations, we are still asking about the otter fraud permitted upon our state and the fact that the commissioners are not following through with their responsibilities of dissemination of information. We'd like to point out that there are only 1,500 commercial fishermen in the state of California. There are 1,500,000 sport fishermen. Now, the entire commercial catch for a season is less than 250,000 fish, 250,000. That is less than one day of the sport fishing catch. It seems hypocrisy is ruling here, the contradictions. You want to save these fish because they commingle with other fish out in the ocean. And so you've restricted the commercial fishermen who have less impact than sport fishing. Sport fishing takes out 8 times more than the entire commercial catch for a year in one day. And this is hypocrisy, although the commercial fishermen are taking this big hit. But you know what's happening? Is this 75-week of fish limit is actually not hurting the little guy and the part-time fishermen. They're thriving. It's only hurting the big boats and the out-of-staters. So then again, you know, what are you really doing? You're not accomplishing any of your stated goals. We don't understand it. And the fact that we have continually asked the federal government many questions for years now, yet we have not gotten one answer about global sonar, about how the military operations are affecting the fish migrations along the West Coast. None of these things are being dealt with. You just ignore it, like withering syndrome.
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I might, Mr. President. Members of the Commission, Bill Cunningham, Deputy Attorney General, and your counsel. Just a very short item I'd like to bring up just as kind of a refresher and a reminder on one of the many subjects you've occasionally heard me lecture about to the Commission in the past. This one is a more specific thing that I think is timely to discuss. It's my understanding that in the next couple of months, the Commission is going to be involved in a variety of very difficult, very lengthy, and sometimes very controversial public discussions regarding everything from marine protected areas to some of your waterfowl and fishing regulations. And I wanted to use this opportunity just to remind all of the commissioners that during this period of heightened interest in a variety of commission issues. You are going to be, and I think appropriately, approached by a variety of members of the public, both individuals and organizations, who wish to catch your ear as an individual commissioner and speak to you about an item of personal interest or of constituency interest that will be on one of these upcoming items. And I wanted to remind all of the commissioners that it is the understanding of myself and my colleagues, as well as I believe the law itself, that the commission and its commissioners are encouraged to meet with and discuss issues of commission business with individuals and groups. But when you make such contacts, there's always a risk associated with those contacts. And I'd ask you to keep just this simple lecture in mind. The problem that we have when commissioners make contacts with individuals or groups about issues of commission business is twofold. The first is that you obtain sometimes insightful information, relevant information, valuable information that is not necessarily shared well with your fellow commissioners. It may be an element of your decision-making process, but it may not be well communicated to your fellow commissioners, and it may not be well reflected on any record of the commission's decision on any of these issues. So much as you may wish to meet with these groups or individuals, I would encourage you also to ask these same people to provide information to all of your commissioners or to the commission itself by bringing either a representative here to speak to the commission or providing correspondence to the commission, show that all of your fellow commissioners can share this information and use it in making a decision. It is important for all of us that our open meeting and our open activities provide the seeds and the information for all of our decision making, so that everybody can see what goes into our decision making process, how it's developed, how it's used, and how it's resolved. The second problem is a more difficult problem sometimes to explain, but is equally as important, and that's that in these contacts you may make with individuals or groups, you may find yourselves listening to a person or party tell you that they have met with another commissioner, and that other commissioner said X, Y, or Z on this same issue. And this is the more critical element for all of us. This is very easy to have happen. It's very easy to do. It oftentimes is done unthinkingly, but it carries a great problem for all of us in that these individuals are then unwittingly serving as a conduit for a kind of communication between commissioners. And the minute that happens on an item of business before the commission, we are going to run afoul of limitations on the Open Meetings Act. It's called a serial meeting. It happens in a variety of ways. Mr. Carlson and myself, all of your commission staff, are also constantly aware of this same problem. We cannot contact more than two of you about any issue or serve as a conduit for any group of you more than two on any issue, because to do so would be to encourage a discussion or resolution out of a meeting of an issue that should be resolved in a meeting. So, again, it's called serial meeting. I can't call you all up and say, what do you think about this issue? Neither can Mr. Carlson, Mr. Fisher, Ms. Shea, or anybody else. I would suggest that even individuals, private individuals and private groups, can oftentimes do the same thing with the best of intents, with the best hope of trying to themselves lobby and obtain a consensus. By getting that very consensus, they have destroyed the process that this commission must follow in obtaining a final decision. So again, this is just a thought and a heads up and a warning, and my typical mother hen lecture that you've all heard me do before. Mr. Flores has probably heard me do this five or six times. But again, every so often it helps to remind the commissioners that serial meetings can happen in a variety of fashions, and please keep your eyes open, watch for this possibility, try to discourage it if you can, and always ask people if they've got valuable comments to bring those comments to all of the commission so all of the commission can hear, can understand, and can vote based upon that information. That's the best way to have a transparent public meeting process. And that's my lecture for the day.
If I can make one clarification, I know you singled me out. That's because of seniority. I've been here the longest, Mr. Carlson, and not
because
of my particular behavior.
I meant that only in the...
No, I know you did, but he's over here, you know, wisecracking.
I'm sorry, Mr. President. It's just right. Because of the time, and I should have said Mr. Kellogg has also heard me do this one before. As he knows, about once a year, I
sunk in with me.
No comments, sir. Okay, that's all I have, Mr. President, members of the Commission. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any new business? Go ahead, Mr. Weakland.
Commissioners Paul Weakland and everybody out in TV land that heard that Mr. Cunningham, we know that violations have occurred. And again, you're just going to sweep it under the carpet. Huh? Well, we can do no wrong because we're exempt by the law. There are some fallacies here. And there are some big-time problems, and we all know that. And, you know, just all of a sudden now we're going to watch our step and walk on eggshells isn't going to help.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Weakland. You have a pleasant rest of August. Any new business? Okay. I wanted to just take a moment. I wanted to take you all on a field trip up north. A forester up in above Placerville has done a marvelous job in restoring a stream and turning it into a facility where people can go by and if they pay, they can fly fish on the stream. It's just a beautiful piece of property in terms of what he's been able to do. And unfortunately, as you all know, I'll be leaving, and I just didn't think I could pull it off. Plus, we had a very hectic day yesterday, and I think you could all use the rest. So the next time we come to Sacramento, if it's, you know, fair weather season, not in the middle of the winter, we'll get you folks up there. And also, it's usually my custom to host you when you're in Sacramento. Okay? So hopefully we'll go shoot for the gold next week. Hearing nothing else, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Till tomorrow.